KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. KOPN Columbia. All right, it's Mike, and here you have it. About 6 minutes after 11 p.m. now, on the 5th of March, 2007, a special day for lots of different reasons. I'll tell you about it later on. Anyway, tonight, one of the reasons it's special, Dr. Ralph Metzner. One of the other reasons it's special, Mr. Noah Earl playing music for us. Lots of other reasons. And thanks, first of all, to Debbie Johnson. Get things out of the way here. Free Range Radio Theater, great stuff as always. Kelvin and Jason doing it up before that. Jazz plus blues equals Amazonian alchemy. Tech Radio, as always, interesting stuff, keeping us up on the quickly changing world of technology. Jeff Wheeler starting things off with Uncommon Light every Monday, 3 to 5 p.m. It's KOPN, Mondays and through the week. Great radio, and it's your imagination station. I'm grateful to be a part of it, okay? All right, let's see. Well, thanks to everyone who listened and participated in the program last week. A big thank you to Dr. John Sheliak. Totally cool guy. How about it, huh? With his fingers on the pulse of the time wave, among other things, like nuclear fusion and zero-point energy and mystical transformation. The guy works for Los Alamos. That's hilarious that he works for Los Alamos, and then he comes on this program and starts talking all that stuff. So anyway, John, you're the man. I love you, and thank you so much for coming on the program. And we'll do it again for sure with Dr. John Sheliak later this year. We also heard some great new music, actually local new music, live in the studio from the Cotton Mollies. really cool new stuff coming out of mid-Missouri here. The music scene here is really bubbling and hearing a lot of great stuff these days, actually. And you can check it all out if you missed it, actually, on the show website. And if you want to listen to the tunes as well, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. That's H-A-G-A-N.com. Go to the program archives. You can download the shows. Everything we've done for the last 3 years is up there. And you can also go to the music archives and find out information and MP3s and all that sort of stuff about the musical guests that have been on the program over that same period of time. Okay, so check it out for yourselves. Share it with your pals. Let me know what you think. And we'll continue to do it and try to improve on it, okay? All right, as I said, tonight, Dr. Ralph Metzner, an icon for sure in the human potential movement for, what, 4 decades, going on 5 decades, Oxford-educated, Harvard PhD psychologist, but really a pioneer in the field of consciousness studies ever since the early graduate days in his work at Harvard with, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert. And Richard Alpert, I guess, was better known as Ram Dass in his later days. But anyhow, Ralph Metzner, another giant, coming up for you in just a little while, Dr. Ralph, okay? And, of course, we'll talk a little more about him as we get closer to the top of the hour. And if you didn't notice, once again, we've got some live music for you here in the studio. My good friend and the amazingly talented Noah Earl. Noah opened the show with a song called, what, Noah?
That one was called, I believe, let's see here. What was that called? I don't have it down yet.
I believe
I wrote it down.
You
and Me Intertwined.
Wow.
Is what I call that one.
Well, I don't care what you call it. A wonderful song. And
although it doesn't, let it be said, refer to you and me intertwined. It's directed toward...
Luckily for both of us.
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's see. We got great music from Noah, and I'm actually going to have him play another song here in just a minute. But one more time, you can find information about all this music that we feature on the program here on the website. Just go to the music archives, okay? And I guess just stay in tune, and we'll have another one from Noah right now. Once you pick one for us here, Noah, you.
Oh, good.
10 minutes. I've got. As always, you know, every time we upgrade the technology here at the station, it creates downgrades in certain ways because other things that used to work don't work anymore,
mm-hmm.
but new things do. So I'm sort of going through that right now as my little jump drive is never recognized anymore by our computers here. So you play us a song.
Okay.
I'll run into the other room and get this thing hot-wired so I can actually pull off of it from another computer, and then we'll roll on down the road.
Okay, okey-doke. Sounds good.
All right, everybody. Noah Earl, by the way, on the web, noahearl.com. It's EARLE.com, NOAH, noahearl.com.
That's true.
And you can link over there from my site as well, but I'll keep my mouth shut here and let Noah play a song for us. What are you going to play now?
I should mention that this song is about the decline in life along the river as experienced by a particular man. It's... The song makes reference to certain aspects of life along the river here in Mid-Missouri, but the idea behind the song was to make it a little bit wider thematically than that. Just life along the river in this age during which, you know, factories are popping up here and there along the river, polluting every river in the watershed. And, Japanese carp are eating up every other smaller fish that there is. So rivers are screwed up, and along with those, life along the river is kind of in decline. So.
All right, KOPN Columbia, it's Noah Earl on Radio Orbit. Back in just a few minutes.
It wasn't the spirit that moved me. It wasn't the 40-knot gale. No, it was looking at that old boat, knowing I'd have to put it up for sale. They say if you ain't got no possessions, no one can take them away. But I said if you have a boat like mine, you want to keep it anyway. But now my world is upside down, wrong side out like a breech-born cat. No one gets an empty slate to separate the wheat from the chaff. And I'm wondering who will write my epitaph. For the grain elevators are the cathedrals of our times. Then the empty boxcar freighters are a symbol of our empty minds. Well, that cornfield used to be underwater when the steamboat of Arabia sang. That cornfield used to be underwater when the steamboat of Arabia sang. And I used to spend my days flying kites, my nights on a riverbank. And now I'm dreaming sepia of an overhandled photograph. Dog eating coffee stain, but still retain damn good for a laugh. And I'm wondering who will write my bait shop at Marina, little place called Party Cove. I used to laugh like a hyena, drink a whiskey by an old wood stove. They built a factory upriver, now the fish ain't worth trying to sell. Who'd want to eat a catfish? It looked like it swam through hell.
Noah Earle, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Thank you, Noah.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about you and the whole business of music making here in Missouri.
All righty.
Some of my listeners, you know, are familiar with you for sure. Maybe. But some maybe aren't. And certainly there are some that are listening from other places other than mid-Missouri right now on the web, and they might be interested as well. So a little bit about you and how you've come up with your particular type of music.
Sure enough. First of all, they should be clued into the fact that, turns out tonight, of all nights, my nose is super clogged, and I feel like I'm sounding just a little bit like Tammy Wynette after a long night at,
I gotta make sure my dad's tuning in. He'll love it.
Yeah, right. Not that I have anything against Tammy Wynette, don't get me wrong.
I like her.
But I happen to have a cold tonight. Well, I'm from Topeka, Kansas originally, but I've lived here in Mid-Missouri for a good little while now, since about 01, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I live up near Hallsville, and Columbia is really my musical home base. I tour around the Midwest quite a bit and really like music.
Just back from Chicago, right?
Indeed, yeah. Over the weekend, I was spending some time up in Chicago and played at Uncommon Ground up there, which is kind of a standard singer-songwriter venue in the area. And, yeah, I was had a couple other shows scheduled. I ended up played it in Champain and supposed to make it up to Wisconsin, but had some road closures and whiteout road conditions that kind of kept me from going there. Thankfully, though, I got to spend a little bit more time in Chicago than I ever have been able to. Usually I'm just in and out. I got to eat some really good pizza up there and some good Costa Rican food. So,
all right, so you play the guitar, obviously?
Yes, indeed. I play a little bit of banjo once in a while. I bring in banjo to play a show, but I only have a repertoire of about a dozen songs on the banjo. So,
never see you play a harmonica, too?
No, I don't really play a harmonica. I guess, to be honest, no offense to anybody who has a singular predilection for this sort of pairing of instruments, but I feel like, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan and you know, a number of other folkies did the guitar and harmonica thing so well that I just don't feel like there's a whole lot of place for it unless you're really good at playing the harmonica with the guitar, and which I happen not to be. But I, once in a while, will grab a kazoo and put it in a harmonica holder and play the kazoo with a couple songs. And that's about as close to the harmonica guitar pairing as I'll get.
All right. Let's see. You have a new piece of music coming out. You got a new disc coming out, right?
Yeah, it's coming out on a great little record label out of Springfield, Missouri. A lot of people here in mid-Missouri will have heard of Big Smith.
Sure.
Well, Big Smith is on Mayapple Records.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Blue is a kind of the front man of Big Smith.
Right.
Great songwriter. He runs the label with his wife, Liz, down there in Springfield. And it's coming out on Mayapple Records. CD release party for it's going to be here in Columbia on the 7th of April.
All right. Wow.
So hopefully it'll be ready just a little bit before that.
Do you have a name for the record?
It's going to be called Postcards from Home.
All right. And it's a full CD, not an EP. It's
No, it's 13 tracks.
13 tracks.
Yeah. It's got Joe Terry's on it. A lot of people who are fans of Missouri music will know Joe Terry, the keyboard player for Dave Alvin, played with Mark Blue Band, plays with Robbie Fulks. He'll be heard on that album on my new CD coming out on a track playing the accordion.
Really?
And then there's a guy named Dean. For some reason, his last name escapes me at the moment. But he's a Branson player, a session player, and has a daily gig, I believe, down in Branson. Used to play with Ricky Skaggs on the pedal steel, and he's on a few tracks, too. So a lot of great players, and even if, you know, the songs are somewhat subpar, I think people really like the instrumentation.
Well, I don't know about being subpar. I love most of the stuff that I've heard you play over the last few years, but before, I got to do a couple things here, but let me ask you a question just in general. You've been sort of around the scene for a while. You're touring around the whole Midwest. What do you make of what's happening in the music scene just in general in this particular area, in Columbia, you know, Kansas City, St. Louis, Lawrence? This is just sort of our neck of the woods here.
I think it's pretty exciting, really. I mean, for me, I mean, honestly, I have made some great friends throughout the past, you know, several years of touring around constantly, that play a variety of you know, styles of music. But one thing that's exciting for me is that it seems as though there are a lot of openings for solo performers. You know, it's a lot of venues would prefer to just pay one person to play rather than trying to promote a whole band and you know, satisfy several different players in a big band with you know, a little bit more payment than they have to give to a solo performer. However, it seems like honestly, I guess I don't have much to compare it to since I've only been in here in Mid, Missouri for a little over 6 years now. But since I've been really pursuing this full-time and seriously, I've been blessed with how generous musicians and, you know, in my circuit, I have occasion to rub elbows with a lot of singer-songwriter types. How generous the musicians have been. Everybody's, you know, the thing thrives on people doing each other favors, and they're willing to. And so, you know, in this business where most people don't expect to actually be able to make it work, they are, I think, more... they're readier, maybe, than in other occupations that I can think of, to help out their fellow musicians and music lovers by, you know, putting in a good word or putting somebody up for the night. So
yeah, you know, it's interesting because that's sort of my experience of running around the world and stuff and seeing like where scenes really thrive and where scenes don't. That seems to be the difference. It seems to be like there's lots and lots of talent everywhere. I don't think that it's a talent issue of one place having more talent than others. It seems to be more of synergy between artists where they really either get together, you know, or they sort of play the, you know, we're the best band in town game and that sort of thing. And
yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's. You got plenty of the songs in your bag, so I'm gonna have you play another one for us here.
I suppose so. Okay.
Maybe something off the new CD. How about you sneak?
Hey,
one
that's
in
a good idea.
Huh?
Sure. This is one.
I'm dying to hear it, by the way, and it's called again. One more time.
It's gonna be called Postcards from Home.
Postcards from Home. Mm-hmm. His name is Noah Earle, and you can find information about Noah on the web at noahearle.com. That's EA. I should just spell the whole thing. I always assume people know how to spell Noah.
Right.
But maybe they don't. It's not K-N-O-W-A-H.
Some people spell Noah N-O-E.
Ah.
Yeah.
As in noetic. Yeah.
Not many people, but some people.
Well, I don't.
You're right. As in noetic.
Yeah,
that's,
I sort of like that,
it's
actually.
It's rare that very many people know that word.
So Noah Earle, N-O-A-H-E-A-R-L-E.com. And here he is. Going to play another song for us. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
It was all
Very nice. Thank you, Noah. We'll be back in just a minute, okay? All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 11:30 now on the 5th of March, 2007. Let me tell you a little bit about how you can get a hold of us, okay? Well, actually, first of all, thanks to whoever's listening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or streaming over the Internet. Every Monday, we broadcast a show from the wonderfully adequate studios here at KOPN in downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we also stream the show live on the web at kopn.org. All right, so if you want to do that, get on the web, go to kopn.org and click on the Listen Live button. It's about a 64K stream, I think, from KOPN. And we also stream the show on Monday night via Cosmic Waves Radio, which is a 24K stream, a little bit slower for people with maybe not the most powerful of internet connections, okay? Anyway, thanks to both entities for making it happen and for giving us the ability to talk to the people locally here and also anybody else around the planet who has the gumption to listen, all right? Also, thanks to Larry, of course, the web wizard, back in action. Busy as beans, but Larry will be showing his face more and more in the next week or two, hopefully, and really glad that he's back with us here. So he's probably listening to the show right now. I don't think he's in the chat room, but I'm sure he's listening. And anyway, thanks to him for all the work that he does, okay? Also, for people out there who are sending art and music and poetry and all this stuff, I just checked my mailbox just a half hour ago or so, and just some wonderful stuff in there. I can't wait to listen to the new music and try to incorporate some of this stuff into the program. And, you know, we always have a place for it on the website. If you have visual art or a poem that you'd like, you know, to put up somewhere, we have places on the site for all this stuff. Just send it to me, and we'll be glad to share it with other people, okay? And speaking of the website, it is www.mikehagan.com, and you can slip on over there and take a look around yourself, see what you think, okay? All right, let's see. The archives, you know, all the shows that we do are there as well, so you can have access to everything that we've ever done just by going over to the website, okay? If you want to share your thoughts with me, the my email address, of course, is orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, at AOL.com, orbitradio at AOL.com. You can get to me through the website as well. We've got a live chat room up and active right now. We've got, Internet forum on the website that's always sort of interesting and lots of topics that are discussed and debated and, you know, delved over there. And I encourage all my guests as well as listeners to join us in all of these interactive sort of opportunities that these technologies are now allowing us to do and to use. So anyway, on the web, MikeHagan.com, as I've said, the phone number here in the studio, if you want to give me a call and we open the lines later, that number will be 573-443-8255. And quickly here, a couple of notes about some guests that are coming up over the next few weeks. Let's see, tonight, Ralph Metzner, Dr. Ralph Metzner, sort of speaks for himself. If you listen to this program, you'll probably be familiar with his work. If not, his most recent project is on the web at Green Earth Found, greenearthfound.org. That's the Green Earth Foundation. But anyway, on the web, greenearthfound.org, you can look at some of the things that he's up to these days. But he's been a tremendous influence on the fields of psychology and human potential for 40 years, you know, going on 50 years. So anyway, tonight, Dr. Ralph Metzner. Next week, Willie Gaspar. We'll talk about the sun. On the 19th, for the equinox, Dr. Jose Arguelles. Tune in for that one, man. I said it before, I hate calling him Dr. Arguelles because he's a shaman, you know, of the highest order. But he has he's got the Western credentials as well, I guess. But anyway, Jose Arguelles, who doesn't do radio, you know, he just doesn't do this sort of stuff. I'm just thrilled and privileged to have him on the program on the 19th of March. And on the 26th, Eric John Phelps. And it should be an interesting program as well. Sort of a shift of gears for sure, though. All right, so who else? John Major Jenkins. I wanted to mention John, the author, of course, of Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 and a whole bunch of other books, but just an absolute scholar when it comes to the ancient history of Mesoamerica and Central America. Anyway, he lives in northern Colorado. And, you know, I was talking on the air last week that I was going to be gone for a week, that I was heading up to Colorado for a little bit of time and going to go to South Dakota for a few days. Well, John lives in northern Colorado, and my son and I had the pleasure to spend the night with John at his place and his wife's place in Windsor, Colorado on Friday. And Alex fell asleep at about 7 o'clock, which was cool. And so John and I got to have a couple beers, and we stayed up till all hours of the morning talking and chatting. And my God, you know, the guy's just amazing. You should see his library. You should just see his library. I mean, I was just blown away. And anyway, it was really cool to have a good amount of time to just sit and talk with John Major Jenkins, and just a thrill, and a wonderful guy who's doing great work. And if you haven't heard any of the programs that we've done with John in the past, you know, check out the archives. Just remarkable stuff. And he'll be on the program again sometime as soon as we get the schedule set up. But anyway, he's a great-hearted man that's doing great work, and I really encourage you guys to check out what he's doing, okay? All right, Paul Stamets, still working on that. Patrick Flanagan, Susan Weed, Barbara Ehrenreich, all the stuff we're trying to put together. Dr. Jane Goodall, we'll see. But I'm talking to, you know, her people, as they say, right? Anyway, we'll see. That'll be amazing. If we can get Jane Goodall on the program, I'd be, like, very pleased, okay? One last thing before we have another song here from Noah. You know, I've been trying to mention people of note that are important, or at least that I find important, you know, when sort of significant dates roll around, anniversaries of sorts. And there was a man who was important to me who died 3 years ago today. His name was CeeLo Black Crow, and he was a leader and an elder of the Oglala Lakota people, who was just one of the most amazing men that I've ever had the privilege to spend time with. You've heard me talk about Wallace Black Elk on the program before. Well, Wallace and CeeLo were sort of like, I don't know, twin brothers who didn't look alike in my sort of view. They were both tremendously influential in my life. And they both died 3 years ago, you know, within a couple of months. Wallace died in January of 2004. And then in March, CeeLo. But he was under the guidance of Nicholas Black Elk. For those of you who have read the book called Black Elk Speaks, you know, you'll be familiar with this particular character in Native American history. But another just super important person who has yet to be recognized for what he's done. But those days are coming, and CeeLo learned a whole lot from Nicholas Black Elk, and along with many of the grandmothers and the grandfathers that were in his life. And he did something in 1968 with Leonard Crow Dog that was just the most amazing thing. They brought the Sundance back. It was something that had been done underground, essentially, for, you know, nearly 100 years. But it was, you know, Sundance is a traditional sacred ceremony that, you know, people participate in, and it's a powerful thing. And it was essentially outlawed in the late 1800s. And, you know, you can outlaw anything, but you can't destroy it. You know, things go underground and they just persist, whether you like it or not. This is what's happening in the Amazon, you know, and in many other places around the world where indigenous peoples and communities are under tremendous threat. They persist, nonetheless. And the Lakota Sundance persisted underground for a long, long time. And with Leonard Crow Dog, CeeLo Black Crow, in 1968, brought it back out of the closet, essentially, and took a stand against the federal marshals of the American government. And until his death in March of 2004, CeeLo did the Sundance every year, and on his family land in South Dakota at Pine Ridge. And anyway, I apologize for getting emotional about it, but I just came back from this place. you know, and it's a special place, and it's a shame that we've allowed it to go unnoticed for so long. What's happening up there, and what's happened up there, and, you know, there are people, all of us, American people, you know. And anyway, my friend CeeLo, he was something else. And I appreciate everything that he has done and that he continues to do for me and for the rest of us, okay? So anyway, CeeLo Black Crow, Aho, my friend. And let's have another song here from my other friend who's in the house here with us tonight, Noah Earle. And I'm going to get Dr. Ralph Metzner on the line with me here, and we will move right along, okay? It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM on the web at kopn.org. Fill up your heart. Thank you, Noah.
Thank you.
What's that called?
That one's called Someday. It's actually on the new record.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Beautiful song.
Sounds better on the record, though, because I don't have a cold one.
Well, I tell you what, man. You sound great, and I love it. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you. I just
see,
like
to see, we got Noah up close and personal, too. We got him blowing his nose, too. I'm going to sell that MP3 on eBay or something.
Yeah,
when he gets all famous, I'll be like, this is Noah Earl blowing his nose on my radio. There we go. Now that's what I'm talking about. That all just right. doubled the value. Noah.
Yeah.
All right. So, Noah Earl, thank you very much. Give me just a minute to take care of a couple things, okay?
Sure will.
I'm going to ask you to play one more before we sort of tail out of here, okay?
Oh, okay.
And I'm also going to ask you to grab a CD for me.
Yeah, I'll do it.
All right, thanks. Everybody, that's Noah Earl on the web, Noah Earl, NoahEarle.com. Wonderful music from an amazing singer-songwriter and super talented guitarist as well. I've talked about Noah on the program a number of times in the last, whatever, year or so, and see him out and about all the time and love his music, and I'm so pleased that he was able to come down and join us tonight and play some songs for us, okay? All right, let's do space weather really quickly here, tell you what's happening in the stars above your heads, all right? The sun, quiet, as a matter of fact. It actually should be quiet right now. We're at what they call solar minimum, have been for the last year or so, but the sun hasn't really been acting that way, but lately it actually has been, so pretty quiet if you're looking at the sun these days, and the lowest activity that we've seen probably in the last 12 months. There was a really cool event in the heavens just a couple nights ago. Actually, as a matter of fact, I was up in Pine Ridge when there was a total lunar eclipse. If you were paying attention to the moon on Friday night, up here in the north, actually, you didn't get to see the whole moon get eclipsed, but you did get to see, like, sort of, I don't know, the northern, I guess if you're looking at the moon, it would be the northeastern corner of it, the upper right corner of the moon, eclipsed for about an hour or so during the moonrise on Friday night, and just a remarkable image to behold, actually, when you have full moon like that, because there's a full moon as well, and it just was rising there in the east and just really big with this big chunk sort of taken out of the right-hand side of it, and then slowly, the full of the moon sort of appears. So anyway, that was happening, and there's some great imagery on the web of that. If people are interested in seeing pictures of it, you can link over there from my great friend Kent Stedman's site over at cyberspaceorbit.com. He's always following this stuff. You can also look at some stuff at spaceweather.com, some great write-ups and imagery about this stuff as well, okay? All right, let's see, what else is happening up there? Well, I've been talking about this Comet McNaught for months, and it's still visible if you're using binoculars or even a reasonable telescope out in your backyard, but that was just such an amazing event that happened that very few people talked about over the last few months that until the thing just totally disappears, I'm always going to tell you that go take a look at Comet McNaught, even though right now it's sort of anticlimactic. If you looked at it a few months ago, you would have been blown away by what you saw up there in the heavens, a naked eye comet that was just remarkable. All right, what else? March 5th, today, the anniversary of a number of things. The 25th anniversary of Venera 14 landing on Venus. That was in 1982. That was a Venus probe that actually landed on the surface of Venus and survived for some like 50 minutes or something, and took all kinds of readings and did all kinds of tests, had a seismometer and this sort of thing, right? People act like exploring the planets is some unattainable task these days. It's very weird because, in 1960 and 1970, they were dropping probes on all these planets and getting all this data back. Now all of a sudden, it's like 2018, they think they're going to go back to the moon. It's like, who are they kidding? I mean, what's going on? I just don't get it. Anyway, a lot of things I don't get. But the 5th of March, also Gerard Mercator, the Flemish map maker and geographer. What did he make? The Mercator projection, right? Anyway, he would be 495 years old today. He was born like 1512. See, there's more useless information for you. What else? All right, now here's some more. Speaking of useless information, March 5th through the 8th, the 2007 Planetary Defense Conference in Washington, D.C. That ought to be an interesting. I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that cluster. March 6th, Gordon Cooper's 80th birthday. An astronaut. That's an interesting choice of words. It should be cosmonauts, not astronauts. I guess the Soviets had it right. Anyway, he flew like Faith 7, which was an orbiter, and he was involved in the Mercury Project, and Gemini 5, actually. March 8th, the discovery of Uranus's rings. Let's leave that one to you guys. Cassini, another flyby, flying by Titan, that interesting moon of Saturn that happened, or that happens on the 10th. We have the usual asteroids and comets zipping by, and I guess that's about it. I'm going to ask Noah to play one more song for us here, I think, and then I'll talk a little bit about a couple things that are in the news, and then we'll come back with Ralph Metzner, Dr. Ralph Metzner, at the top of the hour here at midnight, and really excited about that interview that we're going to be doing here. There's a whole lot of other people that are in the chat room that are talking about it, and sending in notes and comments and questions and all this stuff. So we'll look forward to talking to Ralph in just a few minutes here. But let's talk to Noah again just for a minute before we do that. And we'll hear another song from him. But Noah, let me ask you what's going on with regard to shows and this and that in your life right now. Anything you want to talk about?
Well, let's see here. I don't have a whole lot going on here in Central Missouri right now, but I do have a full list of shows on my website and on my my page on the infernal networking apparatus known as MySpace.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm always, you know, here and there around the Midwest, but also got the CD release here in Central Missouri. I'd just like to reiterate it on the 7th of April over at the Blue Fugue. Also, I wanted to just wish a very, very happy birthday to my friend Debbie up in Chicago tonight. I don't know if she's listening or not, but I know she at least could be listening, and hope she has a very happy turn of age.
All right. I do too. Whoever she might be.
Yeah.
All right. Play a song for us, and then we'll say goodbye.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you have a preference? How about funny, sad, happy?
Happy for sure.
Happy?
Okay. You bet.
Funny?
Whatever you like, my friend. Well, let's see. I got the mic. You got the guitar.
Yes, indeed.
Noah Earle on KOPN Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
All righty.
You said you hate how I play the fiddle. I said I hate your smoker's car. But why do we argue when we should agree? Baby, I came out here to save you, and did the same for me. So don't get your panties in a bunch of dust. Put a little booze in your Hawaiian punch. Everything's gonna be hunky dory in life. Is it choose your own adventure story? Every belt and hiccup almost every single day. Why never worry? Why should I complain? Maybe the world's in a hurry, but I'm a singing in the rain. So don't get your panties in a bunch of dust. Put a little booze in your Hawaiian punch. Everything's gonna be hunky dory in life. Thank you. caffeine in the night, but it's that loving and cuddling moon power that makes us feel alright. I'll never worry, why should we leave our nest? I really do believe our love is heaven blessed. So don't get your panties in a bunch, just put a little booze in your Hawaiian punch. Everything's gonna be hunky dory, cause life is a choose your own adventure story. Well, it's a choose your own adventure story. Life is a choose your own adventure story, yeah.
So much, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Wonderful stuff, everybody. Noah Earl on the web at noaherle.com. NoahEarle.com. And for sure, if you get a chance, Noah's out and about, plays a lot, and he's not always around town. He moves quite a bit, all around the Midwest, and I'm sure soon, probably further out than that. The circle is widening, as they say. So anyway, great luck to you, Noah, and I'll talk to you soon. Go grab me a CD, and I'll play some more tonight, okay?
Thanks, Mike. I'll do it.
All right, everybody, that's Noah. And, hey, what's the MySpace? It's myspace.com/NoahEarle?
Yeah, backslash.
Backslash, yeah, okay. NoahEarle, again, one more time, right? All right, everybody, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's just a few minutes before midnight, so let me just take a peek in the chat room real quick here. And take a peek in the forum. I'll do that as well. And, the forum, I want to encourage people to go over here and use this tool. It's a great way to communicate with people, find like-minded people, and sort of discuss and debate current events and whatever might be happening. But, I mean, the people that are participating in the forum are, like, really creative and interesting folks. I'll read you a few of the titles from some of the threads that are being discussed over there right now. Let's see. Well, they're talking about Rupert Murdoch and MySpace. That's one of the things that's being discussed over there. Ian Lundgold and the Maya. Nevada Radar. The Primacy of Consciousness by Peter Russell being talked about. Dick Cheney. A Huge Hole in the Atlantic Ocean Discovered. A UFO Over Bulgaria. Tibetan Sound Levitation of Large Stones. The lunar eclipse that happened a few nights ago, talking about that. Peruvian Citadel, the earliest ancient solar observatory in the Americas discovered. Something that really interests me, you know. So anyway, more and more, there are pages and pages of this stuff, you know. BBC, CNN videos, Antarctic ice melt reveals exotic creatures. All kinds of different things being talked about and discussed and shared and archived, by the way, on the forum over there at the website. And, you know, we've gotten attacked so many times that we finally got pretty good at protecting this stuff. And I'm pretty confident that you know, the archives of all this stuff is safe now. And, you know, there's a tremendous archive of information that's being built, not only at our site, but all over the web. You know, people are doing amazing things out there with regard to, you know, saving, sharing, and, you know, proliferating ideas and information. It's really hard to destroy something these days. You know, it's really hard to get rid of something these days. It's very easy to sort of immortalize it digitally. So that's what we're doing with this program for sure. We immortalize it digitally, and you're welcome to take a bite out of it and share it with anybody else you like, okay? All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We'll be back in just a couple minutes, actually probably just a minute or so, with the amazing Ralph Metzner. And just stick around for that. And I'll come back and tell you a little bit more about Ralph in just a minute, and we'll get on with business, okay? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, straight up midnight. Back in just a minute.
You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
All right, welcome back, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. My guest tonight is Dr. Ralph Metzner. He's an Oxford and Harvard-educated PhD psychologist. He's been involved in the study of consciousness, human potential, and, just the workings of the mind and the heart for many, many years. All the way back in the days with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert at Harvard, up to this day, with the Green Earth Foundation. It's an absolute pleasure and a privilege to welcome Dr. Ralph Metzner to Radio Orbit, and looking really forward to the conversation. Ralph, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful. Well, let's start things off for people who may not be familiar with your work. And believe it or not, there are still some of them out there. So let's talk a little bit, as much as you'd like, a little bit about your background, who you are, where you came from, and what your interests are.
Well, I was a graduate student in psychology at Harvard in the early 60s. I came there from England, and where I went to Oxford University and studied psychology and philosophy. Before that, I grew up in Germany. I was born in Germany of a German father and Scottish mother, and lived there in the war as a child. So I had the experience of being bombed on as a child. And so I've been interested in war and the causes of war and how to stop it ever since, actually. And one of the interesting things I learned from my childhood from my parents was that here were two people that came from different countries, you know, that were fighting each other. The countries were, but my parents weren't. So, you know how there's always when people are at war, there's always talk about enemies. You know, the Iraqis or whatever. So they always talk about the English are the enemies, and we're going to drive them into the sea, and all this kind of stupid stuff that children talk about and media talk about.
Right.
Well, except in my family, there wasn't that talk at all, because you know they had a family. So what I realized from that later on, I only recognized that. Because enemies don't actually exist. They don't have any objective existence. You make somebody. It's a concept. It's a name that you call somebody else or another group, which then licenses you to, you know, kill or try or destroy them or attack them or whatever.
Right.
Because the English, the Germans were seeing the English as enemies, and the English were looking at the Germans as enemies. So it's a reciprocal game that people play. So that's always stuck in my mind. And I've always been interested in boundary crossings, and so I really got involved in exploring consciousness at Harvard when I participated in the studies on what we call consciousness expanding drugs. Or psychedelic means mind manifesting. At Harvard, and Leary had sort of stumbled on them and recognized and saw and really convinced others, myself included, that he was like an incredible tool. It was like the equivalent to psychology, as for the microscope would be to biology, and the telescope would be to astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
It opens up perspectives and the ability to perceive areas of reality that were simply very difficult to access in any other way. So, and that you had to learn what it meant. When it's like Leary used to say that early biologists, when looking through a microscope, at first they didn't know what it was that they were seeing. Little squigglies and blobs floating around. And it really had us depended all upon her to develop a language for describing these. And so, just like that, people had to develop a language for describing different realms of consciousness. And that's been my interest ever since. It means that, and that's not unique to drugs, of course, in the systems of yoga and meditation and shamanism and all kinds of practices and experiences that people can have of expanded consciousness. And what does that really mean? What does it mean to expand consciousness? And what are the implications of that? And how does it relate to things like healing and spiritual growth and finding meaning in your life and like that? And that's really been my interest ever since.
Well, you've written a bunch of books that are related to lots of these different ideas, including shamanism, including the personal transformation. You've written a lot of stuff about politics and psychology and the greening of the planet and this sort of thing. There's so many things that we could talk about. I think that I'd like to start sort of where we are now, because you have a current project that's called the Green Earth Foundation.
Right.
And maybe we could work our way through that and backwards a little bit into some of these other things, because I think it's sort of a synthesis of a lot of things that you've done.
Well, it's connected because in this way, Green Earth Foundation is a nonprofit educational foundation that we have. There's a website for it.
Yes, let's get that out now, if you don't mind.
Three W's and then Green Earth Found. GreenEarthFound.org.
Okay, www.GreenEarthFound.org. Okay.
And that's basically involved with education and publishing materials, mostly my own, but other people's too. So, and that have to do with expanding one's awareness and developing ecological consciousness. And for 30 years, I taught at California Institute of Integral Studies, an alternative graduate school in San Francisco. I just retired last year. And I used to teach two main courses over the past several years. One is on altered states of consciousness and how they relate to healing and psychological growth, and the other was on ecological consciousness, or I sometimes call it an ecological worldview. I believe we're moving into an era where we're changing the worldview from the worldview of modern science, which is kind of materialistic and reductionistic and quantitative. The universe is basically a great machine, and nature is basically lifeless, just sort of material matter lying around, and nature is, for us to use however we want to use it, and so forth. So resources, as we say, and we can turn them into commodities. And so that's the commonly accepted worldview, and I grew up in it. And the only thing that's really real is the material level of reality, the time, space, matter that you can weigh and measure.
Right, if you can't beat on it with a hammer, it doesn't
exist. Yeah, if you drop it on your foot, it hurts, and stuff like that. So nothing that's like either psychological or spiritual or has value or purpose or meaning in that sense isn't, it's not that people deny that it exists, but it's not subject to scientific study. So science to this day, has a very hard time studying consciousness scientifically. And I believe that this is a mistake, and I'm a follower of William James in that regard, who had this philosophy of radical empiricism, which meant that empiricism means that you base, all knowledge has to be based on experience. And radical empiricism means you don't exclude any experience from knowledge, which modern science does. It excludes, for example, drug experiences or religious experiences. You know, they're dismissed as mystical, they're meaningless. I mean, they may be personally meaningful, but not give knowledge, you see.
Mm.
And drug experiences, for example, for a person like myself or Leary or others, you know, who have explored these realms to come, well, I took this drug and we learned this and this and this. Mainstream science would reject that out of hand and say, well, that's ridiculous. You can't get real knowledge from a drug state. You just changed your brain and, you know, messed up your neurons and... So I don't have to pay any attention to what you say.
But how do they account for the fact that people come back with valid information?
Well, that's the point, yeah. But they come back with valid information, and they come back with healing.
Right.
And with insight, psychological insight and understanding.
Mm.
And, of course, that's what counts.
Mm-hmm.
In the area of health and healing and things like psychotherapy, which I'm a psychotherapist, what counts is the person gets better. So
right, right.
You know, whatever your theory is behind it is really secondary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So... but there is that kind of tension, but I am also committed to science and basing the explorations, I feel, need to be based on observations. They can't just be based on speculation or fantasies. It's not
mm-hmm.
just a matter of cooking up theories. Anybody can cook up theories and make up all kinds of fancy abstractions and label them. And people do that all the time in psychology and elsewhere. But I feel there always has to be some grounding to experience, whether it's clinical observations with patients or whether it's studies or whether it's studies in your own mind. You see, you can make observations. That's what yoga and meditation teaches you, to calm the mind sufficiently so you can observe how your mind works, and observe how your emotions and your mind are connected and your emotions and your perceptions are connected, and how fear and judgment and so forth distort your perception and your understanding and therefore your relationship. So those are all the kinds of things that you can only study in yourself. You can't study them by looking at somebody else. You know, Leary used to crack this joke, and he said, because the other Harvard colleagues, you know, they would say, well, you're not studying it scientifically if you're taking the drug yourself. You're no longer being an objective scientist. He said, well, you can't study it unless you take it, you see.
Mm.
If you were to study somebody taking a psychedelic drug, right, and there's nothing to see. There's no behavior. See, Harvard was dominated by behaviorism. There's no behavior to see. The person is just lying on the ground, not saying anything for hours and hours and hours.
Right,
every
right.
now and again, they may say, oh, oh wow, you know, or something like that. To actually find out what happened, you either have to ask him, that's one way, or the other way is you have to take it yourself.
Do it yourself, right.
And then, of course, you can make comparisons and use all the methods. See, what makes something an area of research scientific is not so much where the data come from, but what you do with them afterwards. You know, you compare them with other, you compare one state with another state, and you compare other different people with what they say. And, you know, if I just have a vision, let's say, no matter what kind of a vision, let's say a dream or a drug state or a mystical vision of some kind, and, you know, if I just have it, I'll never know until if I can talk to one other person. Or I can find one other example, one other person or picture or illustration or story that describes that same experience, then that's the difference between the subjective and the objective, you see.
Mm-hmm.
One plus one makes it objective. That's where Jung sees to where people would come in and they would tell them a dream. And then very weird, strange dream. They might think, oh, this is really weird. And then he would say, oh, let me see, because he was into alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
So he would go to his bookshelf and he might pull out a book of 17th century book on alchemy, and there'd be a picture that would be exactly like the person's dream. The person would say, wow, you know, that means I'm not crazy because somebody else saw the same thing that I saw.
Right.
So it makes a huge difference in health and well-being. So an alchemy has become, you know, a major focus of my interest, and I see it basically as a similar to alchemy, shamanism, and yoga are sort of a trio of traditional systems of transformation.
I want to ask you a question about something that you remarked upon just a minute ago. You made this comment about Leary, how he said that, and in fact I have a quote that's on my website that says, at one point consciousness-altering devices like the microscope and telescope were criminalized for exactly the same reasons that psychedelic plants were in later years. They allowed us to peer into bits and zones of chaos.
Mm.
What do you make of that?
Well, whose quote was that?
That's a Timothy Leary quote, apparently.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't know what he was talking about, to tell you the truth. is sometimes a little nutty, you know, but in a good way.
But it,
but I don't know that they were, you know, looking through a microscope was ever criminalized.
Hmm.
But one thing I do know is that I found out was that you know, the point about that people had to learn to recognize what they were seeing through comparison and communicating what they saw and comparing and repeating and comparing. That's the whole essence of the method, is replication and
right, pattern and recognition. All that.
Yeah. And then, for example, in telescopes, it used to be found that astronomers had what they called a personal error, because they would find certain astronomers would always, you know, shift whatever they were looking at slightly a couple of degrees to the left or something, and somebody else would shift it slightly to the right or would shift the color or something like that. So they had, nowadays that doesn't happen because it's all computerized and so on. But they used to, in the 19th century, have a, it would be known that astronomers had a, like a personal error that they would have to add or subtract to their numerical estimates of what they were seeing. See?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of like an example of how your personality factor can influence your perception. And once you book, and that's the reason for studying your own consciousness rather than somebody else's. Or studying your own consciousness first, so you can become aware of your kind of personal error factors that distort your understanding or your ability to see clearly. You know.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think of the old physician's adage, you know, heal thyself.
Yeah, heal thyself.
And then you hear people talking about, well, gosh, you know, doing this stuff yourself would be silly. It seems like, well, no, that's sort of like the old way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And also know thyself.
You see.
Know thyself. That was the Socratic
right.
injunction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And but the thing that's interesting, too, about heal thyself, you know, people, I often say that to people, yes, you heal yourself. And the people that are best at healing, for example, take something like alcoholism or drug addiction, the people who are most effective at helping alcoholics or drug addicts overcome their addictions are the people who have done the recovery themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Obviously. You know.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean, you know, you have to go through diabetes in order to cure somebody of diabetes if you're a doctor. But for most traditional systems and shamanic medicine, healing, alchemical healing, that's the rule. You work on healing yourself and understanding yourself, then you can help others. That's true in my profession as a psychologist. You know, I understand and I can have empathy for somebody's problems based on my own experience, and then I'm able to help with them. If you can't empathize with somebody else, you can't really help them. And of course, the precondition is that they have to ask. You know, you can never really change anybody yourself. You can set up conditions that enable them to transform themselves in the direction that they choose.
Mm.
So. But, you know, what I was going to say is that all three of those systems, shamanism, which is the oldest, going back to the old Stone Age, and alchemy in the West and yoga in the East, are sort of offshoots or extensions or developments of that, with alchemy becoming more the system of the shamanism of stone, people that work with stone and metal, that extracted metal from stone, then they developed this method, but it was so they'd use the language of material science to describe personal transformation. But it's multi-level, it's holistic, as we would nowadays say. So it's transformation at the physical level, which is what we call healing, and then at the emotional and mental, which would be more psychological, and at the spiritual. So they were deeply spiritual people, so connecting with the spiritual world. And that's true of shamanism and yoga, too. Yoga is the word yoga means connect, you know, connect the human and the spiritual, connect human and the divine, and through practices of interior meditation. So, and in shamanism, the basic method was to go on a shamanic journey, either induced by psychoactive plants or drugs or mushrooms. Nowadays we would say drugs, but they never used drugs. They used plants or mushrooms, fungi. Or rhythmic drumming, and those techniques meant you go on a journey, and a shamanic journey is basically the indigenous name for an altered state of consciousness. It's not; they don't use words like altered states or consciousness. It's just like shamanic journey, meaning it's an internal journey in your mind. The physical body is just lying on the ground, while the assistant of the shaman maybe is beating the drum, And the drum, they say, is that's the horse beat of that's my animal on which I'm riding or flying through the air. And there's always a purpose, you see. There's always a purpose. You don't just go on a trip in order to have a trip or curiosity. The purpose is always having to do with either healing or guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call set or intention is the most important thing in consciousness to understand is the role of intention or set.
Leary
called it the set and setting hypothesis.
Right.
That if you want to understand what goes on, you have to understand the set, which is the intention, and the setting, which is the context. And actually, of those two, the set or the intention is primary because set determines the context. And that's true of anything. That's true of us, you and I, right now, you see, and the people listening. I have a certain intention. You have a certain intention to ask me questions, and I have the intention to share them, and people do too. And so we've created the setting. You've created the setting, basically, using these media so we can communicate. If we didn't have that intention, you know, the chances of our communicating would be very remote.
It's so true. And it's remarkable how the technology, you know, it's weird because I have sort of a dualistic look at technology. I see the trouble that has come from, you know, the advancement of technology. But I also see, I mean, I would never be talking to Ralph Metzner were it not for that same technology.
Well, exactly. And I wouldn't be talking to you and other people in other parts of the country and the world wouldn't be able to listen in.
Mm-hmm.
For a while at CIS, I taught courses that were just totally online. I never met the students.
Tell people
only met them once a year.
Tell people what CIF was.
CIF is the California Institute of Integral Studies.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be called, originally it was called the California Institute of Asian Studies. And it's basically psychology and counseling schools. 80% of the students are psychology and counseling. But they look at Eastern philosophies as well and, you know, how philosophical, and they have programs in philosophy, cosmology and consciousness, and Brian Swim teaches there. He's a cosmologist. And,
mm-hmm.
and they have a program in East-West psychology and programs in the arts and so forth. So it's a pretty interesting. It's fully accredited and everything. And but the focus is on, you know, learning and through experience as well as regular intellectual didactic knowledge and then being able to apply it in your work. And that's what I call alchemical divination, which I teach not really as part of CIIS, but in my own courses, is a method. Divination means accessing sources of knowledge within yourself, like you could call it intuition or your higher self, or in a shamanic context, you would say your spirit guides or your spirit animals or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
For one of two purposes, either having to do with healing something or seeking guidance or vision, you know, for the future. Like in ancient times, there would be people like prophets or, you know, people that would go around and do this kind of prophesying and forecasting for others. But in the way, and usually when we think of divination, and we think of something like the Tarot or the I Ching.
Right.
And that involves, notice that also involves asking a question.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But there's somebody, I think of those as divination accessories or tools. What's the basic process? The basic process is asking a question and getting an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So the shaman asks a question, goes on a shamanic journey, gets the answer, brings it back, and applies it. So in divination, we ask a question. But we're not going on a shamanic journey. So we're going on in the alchemical divination that I teach. It doesn't involve drugs, or you know, it doesn't really. It involves a mild expanded state. You might use the rattle or the drum as kind of give you a rhythmic beat, which helps concentration. But the key is asking, you know, preparing yourself through meditation and centering yourself so your channels are clear, and then being clear about what question it is that you're asking. And then asking the question, and you're asking the question of yourself. You know, when you say, or when I say, or when anybody says something like, I ask myself, you know, this and that, I'm thinking about something and I ask myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's describing a divination with yourself. Because that implies that the use of that sentence implies that you believe that there is something within you that knows more than you do. right? Otherwise, why would you be asking? Doesn't make sense.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
It implies in your use of that sentence that you're trying to access higher self or more wiser self within you. And that's a beautiful thing to do.
Hmm.
We all have that capability.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry to jump in, but let's talk a little bit about consciousness then, because
any time, yeah.
And maybe definitions to start off with, because all the stuff that we're talking about relates directly to our consciousness.
Right.
But a lot of people, you know, we use the word, but I'm not sure we really even know what it means.
Yeah, it's a very complicated, complex concept. It's kind of slippery, and modern science, as I said before, is notoriously difficult. You know, they talk about this Cartesian split, where the French philosopher Descartes in the 17th century split everything into the mind and the body.
Right.
And ever since then, psychologists and philosophers have been trying to put the two together. The mainstream scientific approach to consciousness is to connect it to the brain in some way or other, and that's the only kind of research that's considered legitimate. I actually say that there are three different paradigms for looking at consciousness, and it's important to keep them apart. Now, one is the idea of states of consciousness. A state of consciousness is a division of time during which your consciousness functions differently than it does at other times. So, for example, dreaming and sleeping and waking are three ordinary dreaming sleep and dreamless sleep. Those are two different states.
Hmm.
Actually, it's connected to different kinds of brainwaves and subjectively different. So, those three states are states, different states, with completely different logic, completely different relationship to time and space and matter and everything.
Sure.
You can fly through walls in a dream state.
Right, and a dream can last for days or weeks or something.
Yeah, you can visit your grandmother who's thousands of miles away, and you know you'd be there in an instant and talk to her and give her a hug, and you're just as close to somebody as you feel close to somebody. And you just go there by the intention. So time and space laws, that's completely different. And we know, we have that all the time. You know, we have access to that all the time. You know, Freud used to say, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. I sometimes think he should have said, it's the commoner's road, because everybody can go on it. You see, it's not restricted. And it's free. It doesn't cost anything. No experts. It's just you exploring. So, anyway, but there are many other kinds of states of consciousness, and some of them are, it's important to distinguish that some of them are positive, and expanded states tend to increase your knowledge and your understanding and therefore your ability to make choices and to be free. You know, if you expand consciousness, like you understand, have a deeper understanding of the context of a situation, say in your life or in your relationship or whatever it is that you are, then you have more choices. You know, if we understand what people are doing when they're fighting, for example, or in a conflict, then if those people expand their consciousness and have a deeper understanding of what's really behind the conflict, then they're able to find different ways to resolve their differences, you see. So it's very interesting. But then there are other kinds of states of consciousness that are more contractive. And contracted or fixated states of consciousness are what we call addictions or obsessions and compulsions and those kinds of things. You know, where the addict or the alcoholic might be very fixated on the bottle or the drug or the gambling or whatever it is, the behavior that they're addicted to. And that's why consciousness-expanding drugs or plants have been used and still are used, being used in the treatment of consciousness contracted states like addictions or obsessions, compulsions. Like people are using, there's a research project going on now where psilocybin, which is the active principle of the Mexican mushroom, consciousness expanding, is being used in the treatment of OCD, which is obsessive compulsive.
Right. Dennis McKenna's involved in that.
Right.
It was a friend of mine. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's really a division of the state of consciousness. Is really a division of time between two transition points. So we're in the waking state between the transition point of waking up and falling asleep again. Now we might also fall asleep for other reasons, you know, but. And then in other variations of consciousness, there's always a trigger. So the drug is just like a trigger that catalyzes the movement into another state. It's not what happens in that state is a function of what's going on in your mind and in your environment. It's not a function of the drug. It's not a drug effect, you see. It's like people, it's not like ordinary pharmacology where you say this drug induces this effect. So people don't understand that. They'll never understand psychedelics. has to do with exploring your mind,
mm-hmm.
and it's only one of different ways. So then there's another way that consciousness is used, is referred to different levels of consciousness or different levels. That's like the structure of reality, you know, or the structure of your being. For example, we say body, mind, and spirit. Those are like different levels of consciousness. Or body, soul, spirit, they used to say in old days. Or you say conscious and unconscious, or you say personal conscious and unconscious and collective unconscious. All these different, these are like different levels. It's not a different state of consciousness. You're, you know, those levels kind of exist like different levels of your house. You have a, you know, and those are, there's a traditional in Eastern and Western philosophies, different cosmologies. In shamanism, they call, talk about three worlds, upper world, middle world, lower world,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and like that. And then there's a third meaning of consciousness, really a third paradigm, and that has to do with different stages of your life or different stages that you go through. And I like very much and use this a lot, the idea that the different stages of the life cycle of consciousness is kind of different. You know, like say, compare, I use a model of three stages, like the formative years, which is childhood and youth and young adult up to the first Saturn return.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the end of the 20s.
Right.
And then the middle years would be the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And the difference, and then the elder years are like the 50s, 60s, and, I mean the 60s, 70s, and beyond. So in the, and it'd be four stages if you add the prenatal, which is very, very important. But if you think of just the formative years from birth on to the late 20s, it's where you're learning and growing, and you have lots of teachers, and you gradually expand awareness from being, you know, in the family, and then you have friends and school and other families and the community, and then school and college, and maybe you get married and have children. And but then the Saturn return is usually a huge turning point in everybody's life. And I sometimes ask people to think about what happened, you know, at your Saturn return. And it's usually like the place and the work and the relationships are all changed, all sometimes drastically.
Mm.
People don't necessarily get divorced or anything, but they might really settle down, have a child, or finish going to graduate school and start practicing medicine or law or whatever it is. They build a career, and so they're building and they're contributing, making contributions to the community, they're raising children. So at the late 50s, then the second Saturn return, then maybe, you know, and this is just averages, individuals differ, of course, but then maybe the children have grown up and you've established your career, and then there's that kind of an inward turning, kind of an introversion, a more becoming a more introspective and a kind of a withdrawal, not just necessarily producing less, but maybe less driven and less having to prove something. I don't retire, you might still do things, but you're not so ambitious. And maybe in traditional societies like India, there's people in the second half of life, they would, you know, go on a spiritual trip or join the ashram or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so more reflective, more remembering, and things like that. So in a broad way, you could say the overall kind of quality of consciousness is different in the different life stages.
Okay.
So that's one of the things I'm very interested in. And in my work, in the divination work, you know, we work with that, becoming aware of where you are in the life cycle and what really is your, what kind of a world do you live in. We each live in a world that we have created, you know, through our beliefs. And of course, there is an actual world out there, too.
Right.
And, but each of us interacts with the world through our worldview. And our worldview is what's, you know, our belief about what kind of a world we live in, what kind of a universe we live in, how we feel about it, and what is our belief about what's life all about, and what's human life all about, and what's my human life all about? What's really the meaning of my life?
Right. Well, I tell you what, let's take a break here, okay?
Yeah.
And we'll come back. We'll talk more about alchemical divination and personal transformation, how these things work in our own lives, and because I guess that's what it's all about. It comes down to the individual, I think. I've been reading a lot of Carl Jung. You mentioned Jung earlier.
Yeah.
I'm reading this book right now, rereading, actually, this book, that he wrote in like 1952 called Flying Saucers, a modern myth of things seen in the sky.
I'm just reading that too.
Remarkable.
I'm very interested in that. He was very open to it.
Well, I would like to talk with you maybe a little bit about that later, but at any rate, lots of stuff to talk about, and we'll come back in just a minute, okay?
Okay.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We've got Dr. Ralph Metzner, and we're fortunate enough to be with Ralph tonight, spending some time with him on the phone from his place out on the West Coast, and we'll come back with Ralph in just a few minutes here. And we are also fortunate enough to have the music of Noah Earl. Here's something off Noah's most recent release, not the one that's coming out in the next couple of months here, but this one is called Six Ways to Sunday, and we're going to hear a song called Land of Goshen. But before we do that, we'll mention the websites real quickly one more time. It's Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com, and you can link directly from my site over to my guest site, Ralph Metzner. And the best way to look at what Ralph is up to these days is at www.greenearthfound.org. greenearthfound.org. And of course, Noah Earl on the web at Noah Earl, E-A-R-L-E, NoahEarl.com. All right, and here's one from Noah right now. It's called The Land of Goshen. We'll be back in just 4 or 5 minutes with Dr. Ralph Metzner. Thanks. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Pedal to the metal, past the billboards and the family farm. Me and this highway got an old score to settle, and we're locking arms. I had a dream about my grandma. Said she wanted to see the ocean. She never left the state of Kansas till she went to the land of Goshen. Land of Goshen, place where we can treat each other right. Hold each other in the dark until we see the light. Land of Goshen, in the present day, for the city of Beulah, just too far away. Up a hitchhiker coming down from Omaha, says it's cold up there. He's going back home to nurse his wounds and lose his blues in some love and care. Think I might just do the same now, take the fastest locomotion, get my head out of the labyrinth now, head back to the land of Goshen. Land of Goshen, place where we can treat each other right, so right. Hold each other in the dark until we see the light. Land of Goshen, in the present day, because the city of Beulah, just too far away. Storm in the west and it looks like Armageddon, and it's headed this way. I think I might follow the sun as it goes down. What did Grandma say? Safety is not the same as wisdom. Love is not some magic potion.
when we can live outside tomorrow. Then we reside in the land of Goshen, land of Goshen, place where we can treat each other right, so right. Hold each other through the dark until we see the light. Land of Goshen, in the present day, 'cause the city of Beulah. Just too far away. I had another dream about my grandma. Said she loves Midwestern seasons. She never got as far as Arkansas. Now I know she had a reason. Land of Goshen, place where we can treat each other right, so right. Hold each other in the dark until we see the light. Land of Goshen, in the present day, the city of Beulah. Just too far away.
That's Noah Earle. Six Ways to Sunday. That's a song called The Land of Goshen. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. It's about 12:40 in the AM now on the 6th of March, 2007. We've got Dr. Ralph Metzner on the line with us, and we're going to get right back to him here and say hello. Ralph, hi.
Hello. Yes.
Well,
nice music.
Thank you very much. Yeah, wonderful stuff happening here in the music scene in Columbia, and I like to play some of the stuff on the program here and mix it in with great talk, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right, speaking of that, okay, before the break we were talking about consciousness and a little bit about Jung, and I'd like to talk a little bit about this idea of, you know, this book that I'm reading, Jung talks a lot about individuation and about how important the individual is in sort of overcoming cultural and social crises. You're very interested in this as well, so maybe you could just talk about this a little bit, about where we're at and what you see happening, and maybe some solutions.
Well, yes, individuation, and that relates actually back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the life cycle. See, Jung thought up to your midlife you're working on becoming more of an individual, different from family and society, your own uniqueness. And then after that, you're turning inward, and individuation means wholeness. It means undividedness, actually. That's literally individuated means undivided. And individuation or wholeness is, to me, a very interesting concept, and which I like better, actually, than the concept of unity, which people often talk about. Not that, you know, I'm against unity or anything, but unity can is a different. There can be a state of unity, a state of oneness, where there's a feeling of oneness, but it can sometimes be. Sometimes people think of it as this. They say, "Oh, we just to be a mystical, you know, a drop in a mystic ocean or something like that." I don't think you get very far with that metaphor, because when you're actually in life, see, I believe that your spiritual practice ought to be something that you practice in your life, not just somewhere in a monastery where you sit every now and again, although that can be lovely, or even in a meditation center, to be consciousness. We're always in consciousness something, you know, and are we doing what we're doing with awareness and with compassion, like the Buddhists would say? You approach everything with wisdom, balance of wisdom, equanimity, and with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So, because we can't take time off to just. And so, if we're in a conflict situation, you have to resolve it. Who's going to resolve it for you?
Right.
You know, who's going to? You can't go away and wait for somebody to come and cure you. And we as a society are in the same thing. Our civilization is collapsing.
Right.
You know, Al Gore said, dysfunctional civilization. It's actually collapsing. Even as it's globalizing, it's collapsing all over the world at different rates at different places.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe out here where we're in California, or maybe where you are in Missouri, it looks okay. You know, there's people, houses are still standing, but that's not true of every part of the world.
Right, right.
There are parts of the world like the Middle East where you can't send your child to school without the child possibly being hit by a rocket, or
right.
You know, or there's no food to eat, or there's no access to water, there's no access to electricity. And people living on trash dumps and whole families living on trash dumps, that's not civilization. That's already collapse of civilization, isn't it?
And underlying philosophies seem to be being questioned more and more, too, that are resulting in these things.
Well, it should be. It should be. Like if somebody's living in a trash dump or can't send their child to school without or go out in the street or without being attacked or kidnapped, that they should be questioning, well, what kind of a world is this?
Right.
And people are fleeing, and they're going to another, and that's sort of pretty basic evolutionary survival adaptive. You know, if an organism can't find food to feed its family or to feed itself, then it goes somewhere else. So we're moving into a period where you're already having, you know, hundreds of millions, maybe, you know, tens of millions or more of people who are refugees from poverty and from, people from Africa are flooding into Europe. People from southern countries are flooding into the United States, and people in the United States are all freaked out about this wave of immigrants who's overwhelming us and all this. So, and there's a sense that all the structures of society, you know, justice and fairness, are breaking apart. People are being pulled into a war that they don't believe in, and nobody thinks is a good thing, and they don't seem to be able to stop. We don't seem to be able to stop ourselves. So one naturally would want to question, you know, like what's really happening to us? You see, it can be like really freaky in a way, and kind of depressing, and you know, all of that. And it's very, but at the same time, it can be a tremendous challenge to understand. But it is, you know, in order to be able to understand it and move through it, we have to look at it. We can't pretend that it's going to, you know, change for the better by itself. You know, we're not from Mars or someplace else. We're here. We're it. You know, nobody's going to come and save us. Although people may come, but they're not going to come and save us.
But you know, there seems to be a common idea, though, that regardless of who's doing the saying, that it's those people over there that have to change.
Yes, that's right.
Right. We have to get them to do something different. Whether, you know, but what about back to us and individuals?
Exactly. People often come to me and, you know, in lectures, almost every lecture I give, a talk or a workshop, I say, well, what can we do to get people to wake up and change? And I always say, well, you can't do anything to get people to wake up and change. Just focus on waking up and changing yourself.
Right.
Then it'll carry over from what you're doing to, you know, if you learn to be happy, the Dalai Lama says our goal is to be happy. So if you learn to be happy, then people will ask you, how come you're so happy? What are you doing? What are you taking?
Right.
Or doing or whatever.
Right.
I want to learn like that. I want to learn from you. Sign me up.
That's great. This I love Joseph Campbell, you know.
Yeah.
And he said one time, you know, the vitality of a vital person vitalizes other people, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, well, he said follow your bliss. Well, it sounds a little simplistic, you know.
Yeah.
And it sounds even selfish or narcissistic, you know, me first and blah, blah, blah. But it's not really. I mean, following your bliss is just... I mean, he said more things than that.
Oh, sure.
It's a kind of a simplistic formula.
Right.
But if what that really means is not that bliss is your goal, but bliss would be, that's what the yogis would say, see.
Mm-hmm.
Bliss state is a signal that you're on the right track.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not like you arrived. It doesn't make any sense to say you've arrived.
Mm.
We don't really have any clue as what it would be to be arrived somewhere. We're moving forward on a process. Trying to understand what is, but I do believe that, you know, different people have different purposes in life, you might call them different life paths. That they're not in opposition, or they don't need to be in conflict, but they are different. For example, some people might be primarily on the path of the healer, and other, you know, in various forms, and other people that main path, life path might be that of an artist, or so. And people can have more than one path. And I'm just that's one of the divinations that we work is to help people become more aware of the kind of path that you're on, and how is it on that path? You know, mm-hmm. How do you work and move on that path, and how do you develop your skills and your knowledge and your ability to move on that path? So,
would you talk a little bit about how shamanism relates to this? You have a big part of the website is devoted to shamanism and what you call earth mythology.
Earth mythology, shamanism, right? Mm-hmm. Well, shamanism is, as I mentioned, this is the oldest healing and spiritual practice on the planet. It goes back to who knows how far back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly the old Stone Age. And the basic basic methodology is the shamanic journey, which is an altered state induced by plants or by drumming, but for the purpose of healing and guidance. And that's what, when I talk about alchemical divination, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Alchemy is an extension of shamanism. It's going. Now, in alchemy, they don't talk so much about an altered state. They talk more about an operation. They talk about these operations, like purification is an operation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're purifying, like in yoga, too. You're purifying the nadis, the energy field lines, so that your perception, your understanding can become clearer and you can dissolve the blockages to life energy flow, which cause distress and pain and discomfort and so forth. So it's treating the whole human being as an energy system. And working with meditative methods. So remind me of what you were asking me.
Well, I'm just interested in how shamanism and the ideas of earth mythology can actually catalyze personal transformation.
So that the key thing about shamanism is the world view. See, when you look at, say, the use of something like ayahuasca or psilocybin, you're talking about the use of a plant by shamans.
Mm-hmm.
The plant may contain a drug, which is similar to drugs that psychiatrists have learned to use in modern psychotherapy. And so, so at the level of a molecular substance, shamanic healer in South America and Mexico is using the same molecular substance as a doctor in Carolina or, in the West.
Mm-hmm.
But the underlying worldview is completely different.
Right.
Take something like ayahuasca. So, we go to a doctor if we're sick, and the doctor may give you a pill or a medicine to, make you better, to counteract the sickness in the body. Now, in a tribal animistic, in a situation in South America, you might go to the doctor, you feel depressed or sick or a little bit of both. You go to the doctor, and the doctor takes the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes the medicine in order to see what is the cause of the illness. And so him taking the medicine expands his perception, so he begins to see, and he may start to talk about snakes or animals or a dart that's been put into you or somebody's put sorcery on you.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Then he may start to sing songs, and the songs are actually like the medicinal tools that he's learned in the shamanic equivalent of medical school, that are his ways of calling his spirits. See, in shamanism, you're always working with the spirits mm-hmm. of nature, of plants, of animals, of the rocks and the minerals and the
ancestors.
World. And the ancestors, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So he's calling. So the doctor takes the medicine, starts singing the songs which call the spirits, and they do the healing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a different medical model. See?
And so he's sort of just a conduit for the power.
He's a conduit, and the assumption, see, the two big differences between the shamanic worldview, which is also called animism, and mm-hmm. everything is animated with spirituality or with spirit and with consciousness. So everything is alive with consciousness, which means why you can communicate. You can communicate with the rocks and with the trees and the river and the mountains and the weather, as well as other people, of course, and mm-hmm. the planet as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is full of spirit. So, there are many worlds on many levels, you see. So, not just one level. The Western worldview said there's just one level that's real. Everything else is not real. It's more, we call it merely subjective, you see,
mm-hmm.
and not scientific, so not proven, and so forth. And so they say, no, everything is equally, many levels equally real, not some more real than others. So what your perceptions and dreams are equally as real as perceptions in waking state.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to work with it. You don't just take everything for granted. That's true in waking state too. You have to, check your perceptions, and you can be mistaken, and not yet your intuition is always correct. It's just a different kind of perception. So, and the other big difference is, so in that sense, I would say the shamanic or animistic worldview is actually larger and more inclusive than the modern Western
mm-hmm.
worldview,
right.
which is more limited and more restricted. And that's why I think if we change to a more expanded worldview, and similar movements are happening in science, but people are talking about a systems worldview, which is a relational worldview.
Right.
And that's much more where you see, look at the many levels of reality, not just the one, and you look at the relationships between them. And you think of not so much of individuals and atoms. It's not so much focused on an individual and an atom, but on the relations between things. Everything is a web of life. People talk about the Fritz of Capra and others talk about the web of life, a systems interrelated view.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all ourselves are, interrelated. We're part of that. We're all human beings are all part of that web of life. Our whole essence is being interrelated and interconnected with other forms of life, including other human beings, but other non-human beings as well. And so it's an interesting convergence between the traditional animistic worldview of indigenous people and a systems worldview, which is the avant-garde growing edge of science, where people like Popper, who's a physicist, saying now the foundational science in the postmodern age will be ecology, which is all about relations, how things relate, you see.
Right.
It's not one of those specialized disciplines that you can put into a neat little slot. But you always want to look at the relationships between things. So, including in the sciences, the relation between the world of material reality that we see out there and the inner world of human beings and feelings and intuitions and perceptions and spirit. So that's why in the 16th, 17th century, alchemy and chemistry split apart. See, and just the same way that astronomy and astrology split apart. Because the scientists said, well, we can't really go into this alchemy and astronomy stuff because we're looking at science just the material world. And they had to do that because they had to make a deal with the Catholic Church, which controlled knowledge, you see,
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Right.
The Catholic Church, interesting, it's an ideology at the time, they controlled knowledge. So you couldn't say certain things without, going to jail, like Galileo went to jail.
Right.
Or went in the house arrest, or you could lose your life, like Bruno, for making certain statements. So the deal was struck, which was good for the time, and that's what they had to do. You're the scientist, you study matter and what you can measure and like that, and you stay out of anything having to do with spirit or value or purpose, and that's our department. And people, science is still keeping to that agreement, even although the church doesn't no longer has that power. People are free to believe whatever they want to believe.
Right.
And most scientists don't even have any religious beliefs to speak of. So, but that has to change because it's artificial. There's nothing essential about that. The world is what it is. It's not just limited to our understandings and our theories. It's our theories that are limited.
Right.
So by having a view that we look at how everything is interconnected, then and how the transformations of matter that we can watch, see in the chemical furnace are related to the transformations in our own hearts and our own minds, and how the patterns of the stars and constellations and planets affect our lives and the way we think, then we're looking more at relations. We're not trying to prove anything, but we're aware of the context, you see. And that, so I think one of the big change that's happening for a whole civilization that's required to happen and is happening anyway, whether we want it or not, is like the change that happened in the 16th century from the Earth-centered to a Sun-centered point of view.
Mm-hmm.
We're now realizing, not only are we part of planet, but the planet is part of a solar system. So not only are we Earth beings, we're solar systems beings.
Right.
Solar system is a larger whole, you see. Mm. And then we find, oh, well, the astrologers have been saying that for a long time. it's all these fields of energy interacting with one another that shape life in various ways on this planet. But then the solar system is itself part of a yet larger whole of inconceivable, you know, was it 100 billion to 200 billion different stars and star systems, each with planets potentially full of life, and that itself is only, I mean, it's stupendous. And if the Earth is alive, well, there certainly is the Sun and all the planets, and certainly the galaxy as well, and the other galaxies. Everything is alive. How could it not be?
Right, right.
And the idea that is the common idea that somehow we live in this stupendous universe, you know, like Carl Sagan used to say, with billions and billions of galaxies. To think that this is the only planet in the whole world, the whole universe, where there's intelligent, sentient life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absurd to the point of grotesqueness.
Right, right.
And even NASA will now say that, you know, the probabilities of that this is the only planet with intelligent life on it are vanishing zero, vanishingly small. The universe for we know, we can guess, you know, we can just assume it's filled with intelligent life, much of which may be much further along than we are, and other worlds may be not as far along. And there may be civilizations by the thousands, and some of those civilizations might be visiting us right here and now, and then we find all these crazy people who have been saying, oh, there's a UFO, you know, and I talked to an alien from the Pleiades, and you know, we say, oh, that's ridiculous, you know. And nobody can say that. No academic can say that in a university and keep their job. You know,
right.
They'd be laughed out of court.
Right.
Fortunately, I don't have to worry about that. I'm retired, so I can say what I want. I don't have tenure, so I can't lose tenure.
All right. Well, look, we're top of the hour here. Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk more about aliens and ET and UFOs again. Because,
absolutely.
Because this, again, I go back to this book that Carl Jung wrote,
and I
look at it from a couple of different angles, and I think that it's really worth talking about. So, anyway, okay, everybody. Ralph, just hang in there for a minute. Go get a glass of water, a cup of coffee. We'll be back in a second, okay? All right, everybody. Ralph Metzner on the web at greenearthfound.org, greenearthfound.org. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. KOPN, of course, on the web at KOPN.org. You can listen to the live stream from the website there, and you can also find me at Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And what else? Noah Earle. Here's another one from Noah, from his CD that's entitled Six Ways to Sunday. This is a song called A Letter in My Pocket. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Ralph Metzner.
Lost Monday morning, I'm still lost Friday night. Last Sunday I went crazy, and my mind ain't been right. I've got a letter in my pocket from the Mexican coast, from a woman that I met there in the year of the ghost. Solamente nos queda una gota de agua, la rampante rajeta se juntó una regla, embalsaron el río en dos sitios recién y robaron el pollo de mi grasudo sartén. Guess I'll find my way back now, trouble I've known. might be on the wrong track now, but at least I'm alone. All except for this letter that I keep by my side, and the llama wool sweater I brought along for the ride. Solamente nos queda una gota de agua y la rampante raqueta que fundó una regla y embalsaron el río en dos sitios recién y robaron el pollo de mi grasudo sartén. Y robaron el maldito pollo de mi grasudo sartén. Ah, 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 ah. Rampante raqueta se fundó una regla, embalsaron el río en dos sitios recién y robaron el pollo de mi casudo sartén. ¡Ah!
That's Noah Earle, everybody, from his CD, Six Ways to Sunday. The song is called A Letter in My Pocket. It's Mike Hagan. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. Ralph Metzner. He's talking to us from California, Ralph?
Yes, Sonoma.
Sonoma, California. Wow, beautiful. What's it like this time of year there?
It's very nice, actually, right now, most of the time. Wet and warm during the day, and sometimes it rains. Last year it rained every day in March.
Have you experienced, you know, and we haven't really talked about it yet, but we should with regard to the Green Earth Foundation, and we can talk more about UFOs and ET and this stuff, and how this stuff might work in. But since we're talking about California, what are you seeing in the climate there?
Well, it's kind of a blessed area, you know, where most of the time our climate is mild and mellow, sort of like the Mediterranean. But I'm sure we're of course people say, oh, California is nothing but earthquakes. Well, earthquakes happen, but they don't happen that often.
Right.
And if you happen to be on the fault when it happens, of course it's a big thing. But I'm sure big changes are going to come everywhere on the world. But we're not exactly close to a coast. But these are questions that I think about a lot, and I work with people also, you know, like there's visioning for yourself and then there's visioning for the collective. I wanted to mention, by the way, and I'm sort of mad at myself that I didn't send you this. I have a CD of songs that I composed and recorded and play, and it's called Bardo Blues. It grows out of my work in shamanism and alchemy and meditation and yoga. Maybe I'll send it to you anyway.
Maybe we can plan to have you on the show again sometime, and we'll play some of your music along with it.
Sure.
All right.
Maybe at some point you can give me your address, or I can mail it to you.
Sure.
Or you can email it to me.
All right. Good. We'll do that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we've got all this stuff going on.
Yeah.
And the individual is in the middle of the whole thing. But can we talk a little bit about psychology and about how internal things that are happening in the psyche become externalized? Because that's one of the things that sticks out about that book of flying saucers and the modern myth in the sky that Jung wrote.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's an interesting issue, you know, and in the UFO field, it always comes up. And it comes up in consciousness expanding drug states, too. You know,
mm-hmm.
Then, you know, we always said, everything that you're seeing is a function of your set and your setting. In other words, your internal. That being the internal, what you bring to it, your personality, your outlook, your motivation, your intention. And but then, of course, you're interacting with other people. And that's always true. So our interaction here is, you know, my intentions and your intentions and the audience listening's interests. And they're all weaving together to create a kind of a field where things happen. So it's not under any one person's control, but each of us is responsible for our own, can only be really responsible for our own field of connectedness, and which is our immediate energy field, but also, you know, the field of what phenomenologists would call the life world. And the life world is the web of relationships in which you are involved. And you have certain relationships. Each one of us has certain relationships with people that are unique, and
mm-hmm.
a unique network of family and friends and acquaintances and colleagues, and then people and places, and we have relationships to different places and different groups with members of different communities and tribes and maybe countries and languages as well.
Right.
So in one sense, we could say we each live in our own unique world.
Mm-hmm.
And Heraclitus had this wonderful saying that I like a lot, that was, has sort of multiple levels of meaning. He said, each of us, when we are asleep, each of us lives in our own individual world. But when we awake, we all live in the one great world. So that's true at one obvious level, like sleeping. But it also is true at the ordinary level of waking. So the ordinary waking state is a kind of a sleep state, you see. And the Buddhists and Gurdjieff and many others have said the same thing. Where ordinary waking state is actually a kind of totally subjective state where we're living in our own concepts and moving around. And it's possible to wake up from that.
Mm.
So Buddha means awakened mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he woke up. Yeah,
he woke up, and then what happens? And then we find out that there's this other reality that we're all part of as well. You see, so that's what the expansion of consciousness means. Now Jung said alchemy is the language of the psyche, because he said, scientists say, well, it's the language of chemistry, but you know, they got all deluded because they thought, the alchemists got deluded because they thought you could make gold from lead, and they didn't really, that's really not possible, so.
Right, but that was a way oversimplification. Right?
Yeah, it was a very oversimplification, and it was maybe even a consciously adopted camouflage that the alchemists used to keep the Inquisition off of their back.
Hmm, interesting.
All these guys are just quacks. They're trying to make money and they don't know what they're doing.
Get stoned off of mercury vapors or whatever.
Yes, because it was dangerous to be in publicly. It was just like shamanism. You know, people who practice shamanism are called witches, and you burn them at the stake. You know, but they're consorting with animals, and they know about herbs and all that kind of thing. Unless they have certain herbs in the garden, which we know are dangerous, and we can bust them for that. Just like now, you see, it's not
right.
That different.
Right.
You have a certain plant growing in your backyard, and they can bust you and put you in jail for the rest of your life.
Oh, don't get me started. Oh. Yeah.
So, in some ways, not much has changed. Mm. Jung himself was like really balanced. His life mission, as I've come to understand it, was to establish the reality of the psychic. So he had this concept of synchronicity, which he said, well, the psychic and the physical are connected by meaning, not just by causality. So if you dream that, you know, let's say you dream of a red bird, and then you wake up and there's a red bird at your window,
mm-hmm.
those events are connected and they're very deeply meaningful to you, or they're not causally related.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right.
So he said, this is a principle that's kind of mysterious and interesting, and it's a clue to something is happening. There's a hidden connection that you didn't notice before.
It's a signpost of sorts, you know? Or something.
And in shamanism, you know, I remember one time I went on a vision quest in the desert where you fast and you're just drinking water, and then you, for 4 days you're out by yourself. You're just sort of interacting with nature. And then one day I was there, and you know, three or four birds came, and large birds came sort of flying down this canyon where I was. And I had, it would have been part of my intention that I wanted to connect with some bird spirits. So it was a deeply meaningful event when that happened. Now, for the birds, they could care less about me. You know, they were just flying home or for food or whatever it was that they were doing. But there was a kind of intersection of one world with another. And suddenly we were both part of this larger world. It was beautiful. And those kinds of events can happen, you know, with or without drugs, of course. And we call them mystical states or states of sudden insights, where you kind of see beyond the veil of ordinary reality, and you suddenly wake up and you say, oh my God, what I've been thinking about is just a sort of like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Like a person may wake up and say, I am, for all my life I've been pursuing fame or money, and now I've got fame and money, and what the heck, you know, I'm still not happy. Now I realize I was just a dream. That wasn't really what I wanted. Mm-hmm. What I really wanted was something else. Maybe I call it happiness, or maybe I might call it connection or love or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then once you have that kind of waking up experience, then you have different possibilities for really aligning your true purpose with what you do. Once you have a sense of what your true purpose in life is, then once you have a sense of that, then it gives you a way to prioritize what you're doing and choose the things that and the situations that you want to be involved in and those that are not. You and I may not be able to stop the drug war or any other kind of war, but every action that we take, every thought, every conversation that we have, and will either contribute to more harmony, more understanding, more well-being of other people, or not, or the opposite. And we have that choice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
And you'd never really know. I mean, anybody you could meet could have a story to tell you. I'm sure you know that as a radio interviewer. You know, you have a story to tell you that unexpectedly will reveal something that's like extremely interesting.
Oh, sure. I have it happen all the time. It's remarkable. That's one of the reasons why I love doing this so much.
Yeah.
It's like half the time the stuff that comes out is not what you expected, you know?
Right. That's right. That's what I find when I'm showing people the divination methods. I do guide them into a mildly altered state, but it's not like hypnosis. I'm giving them suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
I take them to a place where they can center themselves, and then they take them to a place where they can ask a question, and then they come up with an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the more unexpected, both to them and to me, the answer is, the more better I feel about it. Because the person themselves, they say, well, I would never have imagined that. I wouldn't have made that up, you see.
Right.
And so then I think it must be real, you see, more likely to be something significant, and I don't know what answer they're going to come up with, because I how would I know, you know, what their inner self knows about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is much greater than me.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I could know. And Jung was like that. He was humble in relationship. He would always follow the guidance of the people he was working with, and I feel I learned as much from the clients and the patients and the students that I work with as I teach them.
It's a two-way street, yeah.
Yeah, it's a group thing. You know, mm-hmm. We're joining together to explore in a joint way, and then we learn from each other. That was something that I learned from Tim Leary. He was really good at that. He was very egalitarian, and people that write some of the obituaries that have appeared have sort of put him down as being narcissistic and egotistic. Well, he had his egotistical side. It's like,
sure, don't we all?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But and I'm not saying by any means that he's a saint. He never claimed he was.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But he was a very egalitarian person and very kind, basically. Mm-hmm. I've never seen him be really mean or petty to people, you know, consistently upbeat, and considering the number of really horrendous situations that he was put in.
Yeah. God, no kidding.
I mean, he had all the excuses in the world to be a paranoid admitter.
Right.
But he wasn't.
Right. He was a riot, actually. He was a great sense of humor. And
yeah, they really tried to, they really did assassinate him, you know, assassinate his character, his reputation, and put him through some really heavy things. You have to wonder, why is he such a threat, you know? This guy, Greenfield, has written a whole biography, you know.
Sure, I mean, he was a poster child for Harvard and the whole gang.
Running,
you know,
him down, yeah, for thousands, maybe millions of people, you know, who saw him as an inspiration, not as a guru. They didn't want, and he hated the idea himself. He was very much of a team person, you know. His model was he would get really pissed off if somebody called him a guru or anything like that. Or his model was like a team project, you know, like baseball, like a game. It was game theory.
Right.
He said, look at everything as a game, meaning that it has certain rules and certain goals and agreed upon rituals and costumes and so forth, and it's subject to change. But when you're playing the game, you play the game.
Right, right.
If you want to play a different game, then you would say to everybody, I'm playing a different game now. It changes. But you don't mix them up, you know.
Right.
You don't impose your game on somebody else unless they ask you to.
Right, right, right.
So, very, very American. That's why he didn't go along with, you know, various people like Aldous Huxley and others said, oh, you've got to keep this secret. That's only for the elite, you know, and only the intellectuals were smart enough to know
handle
how to deal
it,
with that.
Right, right.
Nothing could be further from his, you know, from his value system.
Right.
He says, no, this is far too beautiful and far too valuable just to keep it to a small elite.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Remarkable.
Not that he... That he said everybody should turn on. That was another thing. You see, people said, "Oh, he made people turn on. He gave people drugs, and you know, led to his being fired." All of which is not true. He didn't give drugs to anybody who didn't ask for them.
Right.
And you know, people gave us drugs. And also, it was not illegal.
Right.
It was like discovering a way to a country that we didn't even know existed.
Amazing.
And saying, wow, you know, there are all these interesting things going on in this other country.
Right.
If you want to go there, why don't you try it? Here's the way to get there.
Right.
And it's up to you. You choose.
Right, and all of a sudden you can't go to that country anymore.
Take responsibility for your own consciousness and for your operating your own brain.
Mm.
One of his last books or videos that he made was How to Operate Your Brain.
Huh. Wow. Let me ask you a question about externalizing interior problems. Like, there's this idea that, you know, unfortunately people think that they're only affected by the things that they're conscious of. But we're actually affected by pretty much, I mean, we're affected by everything, whether we're conscious of it or not. And Jung talked about how those sort of things, if you don't recognize or if you don't integrate them, they can manifest themselves externally through the superego or synchronicity and all this sort of thing. Could you talk about that a little bit and what it means?
Yeah. Well, yeah, projection, you know, particularly it comes up in relationship to Jung's idea of what he called the shadow.
Mm.
And in my book, The Unfolding Self, I call that that process, reconciling with the inner enemy. And it's the idea that within us there's often something negative that's unacceptable to us. You might call it evil, or in religious language, they might call it the devil, or the devil part, or the bad part, or something like that. And Jung's idea was, and I think this is correct, is that you have to integrate that shadow as part of your process of moving towards wholeness. You want to integrate that shadow, because if you don't, it can come out in destructive ways. So if you don't... if you're not aware of shadow parts within yourself that might be destructive, let's say, or murderous, and you keep that suppressed inside of you, then it can suddenly come out. You know, and we see that happening all the time. You can read stories like this in the paper all the time. You know, somebody suddenly goes berserk and kills everybody in the post office, or kills a bunch of innocent children, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
People say, oh, he was such a nice man, you know, he never heard a flea, and never did anything. He was kind to people and everything. Well, what happened was somehow we didn't really know what was going on with the guy, and he didn't know either, and something was suddenly triggered in him, and he could no longer do that. So, and then Jung also said that on a, so there's two things that happen with a shadow. One thing, one kind of thing that we use is Freud first discovered this, is that we suppress the negative and just push it or dissociate and disconnect from it, so it's completely unconscious. That's what being in shadow means. We don't, we're not aware of it.
Mm.
Or another language, something that I prefer, actually, the language of it's kind of split off, because it's not really like a shadow, because, you know, a shadow, after all, you can't see.
Right.
It's a metaphor that's sort of good, but also not so good. But anyway, it's split off. It means you're not even aware of it at all.
Right.
It's like having a room in your house that you never go into and you didn't even know existed, and the door is locked. Therefore, you've never cleaned it up, and there might be all kinds of skeletons in the closet.
Right.
Or rotting fungi or whatever. So, and then maybe someday, you know, so that's one strategy. And then if you work with that, then you have to work with, and this is in the kind of work we would do in the divinations that we do. There's ways of uncovering. How do you uncover that? How do you bring it out in a safe way? So, because it's all inside you. There's no real danger. The danger is all in your mind, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So fear in your own mind or your own processes. And so how do you bring that out? But the other way that we all do this, that we deal with unacceptable material, shadow material in ourselves, is by projecting it outward. And that's much trickier to deal with.
Mm.
In other words, and that's the scapegoat, you know, or the projection of our own negative parts onto other people. In other words, those guys over there, they're the ones that are bad. They're the enemies. And they're behaving badly, and they need to be stopped. It's tricky because often there may be a seed of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some way in which the other person is different that's true. Like if you're projecting your negativity onto black people, for example, then you have plenty of black people sitting lying, walking around, and you would project it on. They really are black. They have black skin.
Right.
Now, that doesn't change the fact that whatever you're projecting on them, you're projecting on them.
Right.
Now, they may also have certain qualities that you don't know about, but that, you know, as long as you're projecting, you're not relating to real people. And then other people pick that up.
Mm.
They pick up when they're being projected on, and they see them like the same with women. If a man looks at a woman just as a sex object that, you know, he'd like to have sex with, then the woman naturally will pick that up, and she feels like an object, and she feels like not respected, which is true. She's not being respected for who she is and her being.
Right.
She's being looked at as some kind of a masturbatory object, you know, if I can say that kind of language.
Sure.
And in the same way, if I look at an Iraqi person, you know, then I might just say, under the influence of currently broadcast propaganda media images, oh man, that person's probably a terrorist, and he's probably thinking about blowing up a bomb right now or somewhere, and you know, all of that is happening in the mind of the person who's doing the projecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there, the process of healing or integration means you have to withdraw those projections. You have to withdraw the projections. And in the divinations we do, you know, I ask people to think of it this way. So I imagine, think of somebody that you really hate, who really bugs you, or you say that rubs you the wrong way, or you get irritated every time you're around them, and it seemingly it's not anything that they do. It's just like, you know, maybe even embarrassing to you. Why do they rub you so in the wrong way? So think about that person and then ask yourself, well, what if that person is expressing something that I have in myself that I don't like about myself, but maybe more so? And therefore, it's irritating me because it reminds me of something in myself that I don't like. That can lead to some very interesting discoveries, you know, but very helpful. So integrating with the shadow is one of the three main aspects of the process of individuation that Jung conceived at the first, kind of the first stage, you know, coming to accept some kind of acceptance of the unacceptable part in yourself.
Okay.
I was going to say the second stage is integrating with the opposite gender, or into bringing the two, the male and the female within yourself together. And then the third would be bringing the ego and the self, or the lower self and the higher self together, or self and spirit, or personality and spirit.
Well, I have to ask you a question that came in from email just a minute ago, because it's sort of, this is a girl from South Africa, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And she says, Mike, thanks for the show. Please ask Dr. Metzger, what I am exploring at this moment is transhumanism, and I'm interested in the roots of eugenics. I feel it is the
roots of what?
Eugenics.
Eugenics.
Yes, and she says, I feel it is the fear of the dark by the lighter-skinned peoples, as in Indo-Europeans. Does he have an opinion on this?
She thinks there's fear on by darker-skinned people of lighter-skinned?
She believes it's the other way around, that eugenics, that the roots of eugenics were perhaps in the idea that lighter-skinned people were in fear of the dark, so like the shadow, in other words.
Fear of the dark in general?
Yeah, and the dark and dark-skinned people being a representation of that.
Well, I don't know what to make of that, to tell you the truth.
Well, no, I mean, I just thought, since you were talking about the...
I don't know, that may be going on. I don't know if there's a lot of fear between people, of course. You know, we tend to be afraid of the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a child, when we're a small child, people are often taught, you know, and the adults will often say to the child, for their own protection, you know, like the mother says, the child, don't talk to strangers. You know, don't talk to strangers because they're strange, they're not us.
Right.
We're different than them.
Mm-hmm.
Even our family is, you know, one way, and the neighbor family is not quite us, they're not us. They're different. So children learn very early to make a distinction between us and them. Now, whether that distinction becomes negative or not is a different matter, because in some, like in the story I was telling you earlier about my family, you know, they didn't do the us and them between my parents, didn't do the us and them, us versus them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the English and the Germans are different. They speak a different language. They live in a different place.
Right, but they don't have to be.
They don't have to be
throats.
In antagonism with each other.
Right, absolutely not.
No.
Okay.
Like my parents were the opposite. They loved one another and got married to another and had children.
Mm-hmm.
So then fear, you know, when there's the way I understand it now, and it's just my opinion, I suppose, and then the way I've come to understand it, if the circumstances are peaceful and harmonious, and people are mostly getting their needs met and are peaceful, and there's enough to go around for everyone, then people get along, you know, and peacefully. And there are plenty of examples, for example, like in medieval Spain, where Christians, Jews, and Muslims lived together in the same town and had good relationships with another, and one supported one another and respected one another for maybe 100 years or a couple of 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good time. And then
right.
War broke out, and genocide, and all the other stuff which we know about.
Right.
And similarly, so, but if there's a threat or a stress or a survival need, then there's a tendency for people to get freaked out and scared. You know, there's not enough to go around.
Mm.
And then I have to be worried because these other people, these dark-skinned people, are taking my jobs away,
right.
Which we see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they're not doing their fair share, plus they don't look good and they don't look like us. They're different than us.
Right.
All of that kind of thing. It goes every which way.
Mm-hmm.
Every which way, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in South America, some of the tribes, I heard there were some tribes in the Amazon who, had this idea that the demons, the devils, they came in airplanes from the sky and they had white skins. And they came in airplanes from the sky and they were the devils.
Yeah, you know, not too far from the truth, probably.
No, that was true. Yeah. Right? They really did have to watch out for those guys.
That's right.
Because they came with guns and, you know, sometimes other hidden agendas and take over their land or whatever.
Okay.
So, But fear, you know, more generally, I would say fear is one of the biggest things we have to deal with, because there's ordinary fearful things going on in the environment, but then, you know, there are certain groups and government, or you might call them ruling elites, who use fear, and who use fear as part of the propaganda and control.
Oh, man, that is a serious problem.
That's one of the things I found out about the drug war and the war on terror. Mm-hmm. Want me to talk about that?
Well, let me ask you if you want to take a break. We don't have to. In fact, I'd love to keep talking, but if you need to take a break, we can. If not, we can just keep rolling right on through. We've got about a half hour left, so I say we keep talking, okay?
Okay. Please talk about war
and violence and all this other stuff.
Well, here's something I learned. I used to learn something about the war on drugs when the government started the war on terror. And here's what I learned. So for years I'd wondered about the war on drugs. I could never understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you see all these ads and, you know, like the fried egg and this is your brain. And it's so ridiculous. And this is back in the hip 60s, we already saw that. It was obvious. The kids who were taking drugs, it was complete nonsense. They laughed at it because they knew it was baloney and they saw the agenda behind it. So it wasn't working for them. It didn't do anything to them.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make them afraid. I remember I once did an interview with a young 16-year-old in the 60s, and I asked her, "Are you afraid of drugs?" Like everybody said, she should be. And she said, "No, I'm much more afraid of all the other stuff that's going on in the world around me."
Right.
So anyway, so and these policies, creating fear about these drugs and what these drugs were continuing, and they weren't working, and they justified this war on drugs, which also wasn't working. It wasn't reducing. It never has, since the war on drugs has been going on. It's never had the effect of reducing the use of drugs.
Mm.
It just had the effect of putting lots and lots of people in jail and killing lots and lots of people and making lots and lots of people gangsters, mostly, very, very rich.
Mm-hmm.
So, very strange.
Mm-hmm.
So then the war on terror happened. This is another abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
War on drugs is not really on drugs. You can't do a war on drugs. It's against certain kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
The war on terror is the same thing.
Exactly.
Terror is, like Gore Vidal once said, it's like declaring war on dandruff or something.
Right.
It's an abstraction.
Right.
It's actually war on people.
Mm.
And it's done in such a general way that pretty much anybody you decide is a terrorist, you can attack them and wage war on them.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually the system, the politics under which we presently live.
Yeah, the definition of terrorism is pretty loose.
Yeah, actually, it's up to whoever the person is saying
mm-hmm.
it. And it is said to be open-ended, and there's no vision of when it should end.
Right.
Perpetual.
Right.
Officially.
Officially, exactly.
Yeah,
it's official
perfect,
policy.
And certain groups are profiteering handsomely from it.
Hmm.
So what I realized was that 9/11 and other terrorist events are used, leaving aside for the moment who did it, which is another whole area. But what it was used was obvious to me and many other people, and I've said so, that it was used to create a climate of fear. Which would if the government, the ruling class says, there's dangers out there, you need us to protect you.
Right.
And people say, okay, whatever you do, tell us what to do, what should we do?
Right.
And so then the population gives up all their rights. Exactly. Hitler did exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not making any invidious comparisons. Other people have done the same thing. When the Reichstag burned down, and there too it was the same, similar story. It was not to this day. It's an unsolved crime.
Right. Big questions.
It's all gangs arranged it. But immediately afterwards, he said, "Oh, I was obvious. It's the communists.
Mm-hmm.
That was the terrorists of the day were the communists." And then we can't have this parliament. He just abolished the parliament, and started police state measures and passing all these laws, just like the Patriot Act and all these other laws, reducing liberties and all in the name of fear. And so the drug war and the terror war have the same agenda. Their point is to produce fear in the population, which then allows the ruling elites to set up these control systems. And basically, we're moving into a police state situation.
Mm.
very rapidly. We're not quite at this level at which the Nazis were, and hopefully they won't get there, but it's we're at the stage in the early 30s, I would say, that the Nazis in Germany were at the early 30s.
Very
of course, you know, in a one way, you can't really make those kind of comparisons. The United States is a much bigger country than a much more diverse country than Germany ever was.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it'll ever really come to that place. I think actually the present gang that's in the government is going to be removed sooner or later, and things are going to change. But it's kind of. But as an individual, I think one of the most important things you can do is disengage from this fear mongering, and see through it. And I think most people do. I mean, I don't. People go through these airport security rooms, and they know it's pretty much.
Oh, God. I just flew back from Colorado today, as a matter of fact, and Denver's one of the worst, as a matter of fact. And I lived there for a long time in Denver. I went through DIA, and oh, my gosh, just enough to drive you crazy.
Yeah.
So,
and it's just
silliness.
Annoying.
It's absolutely,
you know?
Silliness.
Yeah. It's silly and annoying, and people do it. They tolerate it because what choice do they have?
Right.
You know, they want to fly someplace, and these are the guys that make the rules, and they've made this rule.
Right.
So. And it doesn't increase respect for people, but so, you know, and the parallel with the drug war is this, you see, because those propaganda advertisements like that they played, you know, if you bought some drugs today, you supported some family that killed some terrorists, you know, because and all that stuff, or you ruined your brain, then those media of fear propaganda are not aimed at the kids who are taking drugs or at the young people or the people who are taking drugs. They know that those people don't care, you know, and don't believe the message anyway.
Right.
It's actually aimed
at the other ones. Yeah.
The non-drug taking parents and conservative people who, you know, who are very afraid of the drugs that the young people are taking, and then who will then pass laws.
Right.
That are restrictive, and they vote. You see, they vote, and I sometimes say to people, you know, who are in the drug culture, you know, the ruling elites, they don't actually care whether you turn your brain into fried eggs or, you know, cheese with holes in it, as they did in that one propaganda film about MDMA. Your brain is just like Swiss cheese.
Right, right.
They make up this stuff. You know,
oh,
it sounds vaguely scientific.
Silly.
The
yeah.
brain doesn't have holes in it like that. But anyway, so they don't really care because, you know, if you do that and then you get caught, you just get put in jail. They don't really care. The message is addressed to other people who are voting and making the laws. And our responsibility is to disengage from that fear system so we can adequately and realistically deal with the real threats that we're confronted with,
right, okay.
to which these phony laws and regulations, you know, don't provide any protection.
Okay. So. All right, questions that are coming up, okay?
Yes.
Dear Dr. Metzner, thanks so much for your work. What did you make of the Johns Hopkins psilocybin report that came out in June or July of last year?
Well, it was interesting. It was a repeat, you know, of a study that we already did as part of our Harvard project of about 40 years ago, 1963 or thereabout. It was called the Good Friday Study, or that was done by Walter Pankey and written up, where psilocybin was given in a double-blind. This is, our study was actually more controlled than the Johns Hopkins one was, but it's a good thing that it was done again. No, it's like 40 years later. You know, if you think about it, for 40 years, no research has been done at all on LSD or psilocybin.
It's outrageous.
Zero, you know. So it was in our study, it was already shown that you can give a double-blind, placebo-controlled psilocybin to, you know, theology students that were preset to be interested in religious experience, and some of them got the psilocybin, some enough, and the setting was a chapel during a service and everything, and then they were interviewed afterwards, and they had all the characteristics of mystical experiences. So,
how could it be? How do they justify the Schedule 1 classification?
They don't justify it. That's, you know, there's no justification for it. It has nothing to do with classification and the scheduling is not a scientific matter.
It's just political.
It's not that these drugs are completely different. It's a purely political thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened to me twice now in my career, once with LSD in the 60s and once and psychedelics, and then once with MDMA in the 80s. You know, MDMA was a drug, the most effective drug as an adjunct to psychotherapy.
For a clinical drug, right?
What?
A clinical drug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for psychotherapy, because it expands awareness just on the emotional band. It puts you into this kind of positive emotional empathic state without change giving you visions or hallucinations or anything like that, or patterns or anything visual.
Right.
You're thinking everything is the same, but your emotions are very positive and you're very unafraid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the most wonderful tool for therapy that was ever discovered. So that it was such a positive thing that people wanted to take it even if they weren't in therapy,
right.
And with their friends and loved ones and so on. And so it kind of migrated out of the clinics and therapist offices into the public, and enterprising people fabricated it and manufactured it. It was all legal, it wasn't illegal, and started distributing in it. And then once it became widely distributed and people were making money of it, then the government stepped in and they had hearings and they made it illegal. And they made up scare stories, and just like they did with LSD. So twice in my life I've had the experience now of working with a certain method, and then all of a sudden if I were to continue I would be a felon. Not because somebody was harmed or I did something dangerous to somebody or harmful, but because of a political decision made at another level.
Amazing.
It's kind of odd.
It is remarkable.
It talks about crimes without victims.
Oh,
but it gives, I don't mind. It gives, it was, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So it's part of the climate, or the social climate, or the socio-political climate.
It's amazing.
It's
amazing how long it's persisted, though. As you mentioned, I mean, this is 40 years ago that you guys were doing this amazing work, and it's not as if the work wasn't profound. I mean, it's profound stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's continuing now. I mean, it is picking up. The research, research officially approved, permitted, government approved research projects are increasing.
Mm-hmm.
With MDMA, with psilocybin, even with LSD, with headaches and so on. Now, the underground sort of research, that's countercultural experimentation, of course, has continued all along. And it's like a different stream that, but the above ground official research, is an indication of an important thing. I could just take one example that a friend of mine, Charles Grove, was a psychiatrist at UCLA.
Sure, sure.
Have you met him or
no?
You
but I know his work. I know his work. He's not been on the program, but he's on my list.
You might want to have him on the program sometimes. So he's got permission. He previously got permission to do work with MDMA with dying people. Now he's still got a project going. He's giving psilocybin to terminal cancer patients.
Is he involved with Hefter, with the people?
Yes, yes, yeah, Hefter, yeah, okay. Dennis McKenna, right.
Right,
yeah.
Right, and Dave Nichols and
some
of those other guys.
Right.
Okay, great, great, great.
Yeah, so, which is a research, a group that sponsors and promotes, scientific research and medical research on the use of applications of these substances. So what I thought was really interesting is that he got permission to give a drug that wasn't a cure for cancer. Nobody claimed that it would cure the cancer,
mm-hmm.
but it would improve the quality of life of somebody who was dying.
Right,
it's
right.
Only terminal stage 4 terminal cancer, so people who have 2 to 3 months to live, that it was given to. And that's, I think, a kind of a breakthrough, a minor breakthrough, because the idea that you could take a substance that would, just increase your well-being, that's beautiful.
Right.
And it's a kind of a foot in the door, and I hope there's more of that. It's sort of analogous to people, sometimes people ask me, do you see some hopeful sign? And I say, well, I see that would be a hopeful sign. And then things like more people giving birth at home
mm-hmm.
rather than a hospital, and more people dying at home rather than a hospital.
Very.
I think that's a positive development.
Wow.
Because birth and death are not medical conditions requiring hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
They're something we've always, it's always been done in the family, at home.
Right.
And surrounded by those that love you. Of course, if there's complications, then you need help. But that can be arranged, but you don't want to make it part of the medical establishment. And that seems like a good thing. And people taking more responsibility for their own health and well-being than, you know, turning it over to authorities. So that's all part of also analogous to this thing about fear, you know, not going along with the fear just because the rulers tell you, oh, you should be afraid, and
right.
you need us to protect you and all of that. It's a protection racket, you know.
But
the military governments of the world would like us to believe that they need
sort of,
us to protect them.
Sort of oldest trick in the book.
Right? Yeah. And that ties into what we were talking earlier. We didn't get much to talk about UFOs, you know.
Mm.
There's this fear of UFOs.
Right.
Fear of aliens that are going to invade this country and invade the world. But then there are people who've contacted these or seen UFOs, and none of the UFOs have ever attacked people. You know, they've never dropped any bombs. They've never shot any of them down.
Right. I mean, they obviously, I mean, this just seems to fall to logic that if they can make it here from wherever they come from, which must be,
yeah.
you know, quite far away,
right.
But I mean, they obviously probably don't really need us for a whole lot of things.
No. And then also what it means is like, yeah, that's a very interesting example, and I thought about that a lot recently, because once I saw this film, you know, where that was shot in Mexico City on television, where in 2004, that's
I've
not so long
it.
Ago.
Mm-hmm. I've
in
seen
2004,
it.
They were like, in Mexico City, there were like sightings of over 100 UFOs in the night sky, and the Mexican army, unlike the American military, they the Air Force, they called the television stations and said, look, you know, and so hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people saw it on primetime television.
Hmm.
All these dozens of USOs flying in formation across the night sky. I actually saw a film of this with the television commentator saying, yeah, you can see them in the formation. Here's a group of nine on flying in formation across the night sky. And at night, they're like flaming orbs. During the day, they're saucer-shaped or cigar-shaped. At night, they look like suns or flaming circles and spheres. And so when you see that, you recognize, you know, you can tell they're not planes or anything else, or weather balloons.
Mm-hmm.
You see that, you realize we're being visited by an advanced civilization that's not harming us, but is just there visiting.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing, when you can let that fact in, it's an amazing consciousness-expanding experience. Because, and like you said, you know that they're much more advanced than we are, because we're not going anywhere.
Right. We
can
barely
make it
to
the moon.
We can't even control
a
third world economy, you know?
So they're here, and our science tells us space travel is impossible, because you can't exceed the speed of light.
Right.
So the nearest star system is Alpha Centauri, that's 4 light years away. It would take us, with present technology, 150,000 years to get there. So they're not obviously using that technology. They're doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more advanced. That does a very interesting thing to human consciousness,
mm-hmm.
to suddenly realize that you're in the presence of an advanced civilization. And then you wonder, you don't really know what they're doing or why they're here. Or why are they interested? Or what is their intention? Because you can tell they're not bombing us or killing us.
Right.
So, you know,
or landing on the White House South Lawn.
No,
they're
obviously not doing that. But then, there's this kind of huge literature that, you know, that apparently, which I think is without a doubt is true, that there has been, you know, a concerted cover-up of the degree of contact and the extent of contact that's been kept secret because. For, you know, a whole variety of reasons, some of them kind of unsavory reasons,
because
people want to lay their hands on that technology and use it to do the usual thing of militarily dominating and exploiting other people and other countries and for their weaponry and their technology and for their control agenda. So, but that all has to change, and I think it is going to change. And I think if it becomes publicly accepted knowledge around the world that actually there is ET presence going on.
Mm-hmm.
There are upwards of maybe dozens of different civilizations from other worlds visiting us and have been visiting us for hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, and interacting with humans in multiple ways. That will be a change that will change everything. It will change religion. It will change science. It will change technology. It would change politics, economics, energy use. Just think of energy use.
Oh, my gosh.
People are not burning fossil fuels.
Right, right, right.
Their vessels are silent.
Ralph, we've got time for one more question, I think, that's sort of related to this. It just came in from the chat room here. And I'll try to sort of encapsulate it here, but they're talking about the idea of the UFO as alchemical transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And the person says, essentially, what would it mean if someone actually achieved the alchemical transformation? In other words, if somebody actually got hold of the stone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is that even worthy of discussion?
Well, I think anybody can find the stone. That's what the alchemical texts say themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The stone is like the kingdom of heaven. In fact, I wrote something on my website where I compared some of the statements about what is the stone of the wise. And it's like what the Gnostic Gospels say about Jesus saying about the kingdom of heaven. They said, the stone is in everything, they say. It's in everything. First of all, it's a liquid as well as a stone. So it's a water stone. So I think it's a condition of consciousness in which you know. It's like what the Tibetan Buddhists call the Vajra.
Mm.
It's kind of lightning and thunderbolt. So they say, lightning and diamond. Indestructible diamond, stone, and lightning. Brilliant. So it's objective knowledge, objective consciousness. But it's fluid. It can change. It has to do with your relationship to reality. So it can change. It can be, and it can be all around. It's spiritual. So it can be in the trees. That's what the alchemist said. It can be in the trees and the mountains and the rivers and in your brain, in your head, or in your body.
And the birds, you mentioned the birds earlier, really,
the
language
birds
of the birds.
All
know.
Around.
Yeah.
And so inside and outside you, it's not, it's not so much an object, although Albert Hofmann did discover this amazing molecule that is tiny, the most potent drug ever known, drug totally unlike any other drug. Doesn't really change anything in your body, but changes your consciousness in the most profound way, unimaginable. Unimaginably profound. It's impossible to imagine what it's like,
right,
unless you've actually experienced it.
Right.
And almost like an atomic bomb. And it's sort of synchronistic that it was
very interesting. The co-development of those things.
Yeah.
And the mushroom as well.
Talk about a synchronicity.
Yeah. I think about the mushroom and then the mushroom cloud, one on one shoulder and one on the other.
Oh, yeah. And then the bringing of these traditional indigenous shamanic knowledge about things like the mushroom and ayahuasca, which happened in the 50s, and bringing that into kind of a cultural blood transfusion or a cultural transfusion of knowledge and a rediscovery of ancient shamanic traditions of expanding knowledge and connecting with spirit and learning to live more harmoniously with others. That's why shamanism is attractive, because it, to people, I believe, is because it reawakens the possibility of having a direct psychical and spiritual connection with the natural world, which is our birthright, and because we are a part of the great web of life, and it's only our preconceived ideas that separate us from the awareness of it. So what it would mean for an individual to find the stone for themselves, it's something that you can only experience for yourself. You can't really say it for somebody else. I mean, we can look at somebody like Buddha or the Dalai Lama, and bow before their wisdom as we listen to what they tell us. And I would certainly do that and honor anyone that would be able to teach like that. The Dalai Lama would say that, when he was asked one time whether it was possible, whether there could be about drugs that could help you reach enlightenment, and he said, "Well, I sure hope so." And he laughed. he didn't dismiss the possibility.
Right, right, I love it. I love it.
Something that he didn't have any personal knowledge of.
Mm-hmm.
But if it would have that consequence, it would be a good thing. So
wonderful.
I would hope so.
Wow. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, Ralph. But a great place to do so.
Yes. All right.
And thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we've got, you know, I've got a whole list of things that we didn't get to. We didn't even take any calls. We got all kinds of questions. People want to talk about magic. People want to talk about about your books, about unfolding the unfolding self, about personal transformation,
right.
Well of remembrance.
Yeah.
So anyway,
all listed on the website. And there's another website as well called Metzner Alchemical Divination, but you can get it. Going for thegreenearthfound.org.
Okay.
Thank you. I
enjoyed
it very much.
Great. We'll do it again sometime, and I'll be in touch with you, okay?
Okay, great.
Thanks very much, Ralph.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Ralph Metzner. Wonderful stuff. On the web, www.greenearthfound.org. And you can link up to a bunch of other things from there. And you can always connect now to Ralph's site from my site, of course, at mikehagan.com. All right. We're just running out of ticks here, so I'm going to say goodbye real quickly. Come on back next week. We've got Willie Gaspar. We'll be talking about the sun and solar cycles and this sort of thing. Very interesting stuff happening up there on our star. So we'll speak with Willie Gaspar about solar cycles and lots of other things, including the Mayan calendar and some other stuff with Willie next week. I'm not sure what we'll do for music, but it'll be good. Thanks to Noah Earl for wonderful stuff. Again, Ralph Metzner, great, great privilege and pleasure to speak with Dr. Metzner. And to everybody out there listening to the program, thanks so much. As always, we'll come back at you next week, okay? On the web, one more time, KOPN.org. I'm Mike Hagan. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. And we'll finish things off here with one more from my friend Noah Earl. On the web at Noah Earl. .com. This one is called You Always Do. Ain't it the truth? It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Thanks a lot. Stick around for Ruth. She'll be here in just a minute.
In Grandpa's big backyard, Auburn Town's just over the hill. We make believe all afternoon we can fly off the chicken coop. From time to time one of us will, and we all sing together in the family room. Songs of inspiration and regret, songs about salvation, songs of love that's doomed. Seeing just how lonely one person can get. And I sit beside the crawdad stream I am trying to hide from you. I'm carried away by another daydream, and you've caught me again like you always do. Spent a day in November in the hospital lounge. My brother has been losing blood somehow. They've got him looking like an invalid and feeling like a corpse. They're taking him to surgery right now. So I go play mini basketball in the nursery. My wrist bleeds cause I slam dunk too hard. I see the blood is what my brother needs to live. Go back to running through Grandpa's big backyard. So I say a prayer for our two souls. I don't want to go to hell, and I don't want you to. I do believe, whether I have faith or not, that you will get well, like you always do. I spent one day last week down in Larrytown. I don't remember which month it was. We get a 6 or 12 of honey brown, just enough for both of us to get a little buzz. And we go over some old times and new times, like two guys who haven't spoken in a while. You buy a pack of smokes with a stack of dimes. How can you be such trouble and still make everybody smile? Our own separate ways have turned into this one big haze of smoke we both blew. I mentioned the loan, then I leave you alone, and you turn it into a joke like you always do. you always, always do. Another day in mid-April out at Grandpa's place, sifting through old dusty magazines. When we get back inside, Mama bends down to spit shine my face, tosses you another clean pair of jeans, and Grandpa calls you Pistol and me Peanut. But he says more to the guy who calls the play-by-play. We beg Mom and Dad to teach us to speak in tongues, but can't seem to figure out what it is we're trying to say. And our own separate ways have turned into this one big hazy brew. You need to unwind, you will know where to find me, just like you always do. You always, always do.